The wagon upon which she stood wasn't a particularly inspiring dais, but it was better than the pile of boxes she'd used in the last town. At least her new form, envoy form, was tall, the tallest she'd ever worn. It was a form of power, and brought strange abilities, primarily the ability to speak and understand all languages. That made it perfect for instructing the crowds of Alethi Parshmen. "They fought for years to exterminate us," she said to command. "They could not suffer slaves who could think, who could resist. They worked to crush us, lest we inspire a revolution." The people gathered around the wagon bore thick lines of marbling, of red and either black or white. Venley's own white and red was far more delicate, with intricate swirls. She continued, speaking triumphantly to the rhythm of command, telling these people, as she'd told many others, her story, at least the version of it that Odium had instructed her to tell. She told them she'd personally discovered new sprend to bond, creating a form that would summon the Everstorm. The story left out that Ulim had done much of the work, giving her the secrets of storm form. Odium obviously wanted to paint the listeners as a heroic group, with Venley their brave leader. The listeners were to be the foundation myth of his growing empire, the last of the old generation who had fought bravely against the Alethi, then sacrificed themselves to free their enslaved brothers and sisters. Hauntingly, the narrative said that Venley's people were now extinct, save herself. The former slaves listened, rapt by her narrative. She told it well, she should, given how often she'd related it these last weeks. She ended with the call to action, as specifically instructed. "My people have passed, joining the eternal songs of Roshar," she said. "The day now belongs to you. We had named ourselves listeners because of the songs we heard. These are your heritage. But you are not to merely listen, but sing. Adopt the rhythms of your ancestors and build a nation here. You must work, not for the slavers who once held your minds, but for the future, for your children, and for us, those who died that you might exist." They cheered to the rhythm of excitement. That was good to hear, even if it was an inferior rhythm. Venley heard something better now, new, powerful rhythms that accompanied forms of power. Yet, hearing those old rhythms awakened something in her, a memory. She put her hand to the pouch at her belt. "How like the Alethi these people act," she thought. She had found humans to be stern, angry, always walking about with their emotions worn openly, prisoners to what they felt. These former slaves were similar. Even their jokes were Alethi, often biting toward those to whom they were closest. At the conclusion of her speech, an unfamiliar voidspren ushered the people back to work. She'd learned there were three levels in the hierarchy of Odium's people. There were these common singers, who wore the ordinary forms Venley's people had used. Then there were those called regals, like herself, who were distinguished by forms of power, created by bonding one of several varieties of voidspren. At the top were the fused, though she had trouble placing spren like Ulim and others. They obviously outranked the common singers, but what of the regals? She saw no humans in this town. Those had been rounded up or chased off. She'd overheard some fused saying that human armies still fought in western Alethkar, but this eastern section was completely singer-controlled. Remarkable, considering how the humans greatly outnumbered the singers. The Alethi collapse was due in part to the Everstorm, in part to the arrival of the fused, and in part to the fact that the Alethi had repeatedly conscripted eligible men for their wars. Venley settled down on the back of the cart, and a female singer brought her a cup of water, which she took gladly. Proclaiming yourself as the savior of an entire people was thirsty work. The singer woman lingered. She wore an Alethi dress, with the left hand covered up.
Is your story really true?
Of course it is, Venli said to Conceit.
You doubt? No, of course not. It's just... it's hard to imagine. Parshman fighting.
Call yourselves singers, not Parshman.
Yes, of course.
The femalein held her hand to her face, as if embarrassed.
Speak to the rhythms to express apology, Venli said. Use appreciation to thank someone for correction, or anxiety to highlight your frustration. Consolation if you are truly contrite.
Yes, brightness.
Oh, Esh and I, they have so far to go. The woman scampered away. That lopsided dress looked ridiculous. There was no reason to distinguish between the genders except in mate form. Humming to ridicule, Venli hopped down, then walked through the town, head high. The singers wore mostly work form or nimble form, though a few, like the femalein who had brought the water, wore scholar form, with long hair strands and angular features. She hummed to fury. Her people had spent generations struggling to discover new forms, and here these people were given a dozen different options? How could they value that gift without knowing the struggle? They gave Venli deference, bowing like humans as she approached the town's mansion. She had to admit there was something very satisfying about that.
"What are you so smug about?"
Rhyme demanded to destruction when Venli stepped inside. The tall fused waited by the window, hovering, as always, a few feet off the ground, his cloak hanging down and resting on the floor. Venli's sense of authority evaporated.
"I can't help but feel as if I'm among babes here."
"If they are babes, you are a toddler."
A second fused sat on the floor amid the chairs. That one never spoke. Venli didn't know the femalein's name and found her constant grin and unblinking eyes upsetting. Venli joined Rhein by the window, looking out at the singers who populated the village, working the land, farming. Their lives might not have changed much, but they had their songs back. That meant everything.
"We should bring them human slaves, ancient one," Venli said to subservience. "I fear that there is too much land here. If you really want these villages to supply your armies, they'll need more workers."
Rhein glanced at her. She'd found that if she spoke to him respectfully, and if she spoke in the ancient tongue, her words were less likely to be dismissed.
"There are those among us who agree with you, child," Rhein said.
"You do not?"
"No. We will need to watch the humans constantly. At any moment, any of them could manifest powers from the enemy. We killed him, and yet he fights on through his surge binders."
Surge binders. Foolishly, the old songs spoke highly of them.
"How can they bind Spren, ancient one?"
she asked a subservience.
"Humans don't, you know..."
"So timid," he said to ridicule. "Why is mentioning gem hearts so difficult?"
"They are sacred and personal."
Listener gem hearts were not gaudy or ostentatious, like those of great shells. Clouded white, almost the color of bone, they were beautiful, intimate things.
"They're a part of you," Rhein said. "The dead body's taboo, the refusal to talk of gem hearts. You're as bad as those out there walking around with one hand covered."
"What? That was unfair." She attuned fury.
"It shocked us when it first happened," Rhein eventually said. "Humans don't have gem hearts. How could they bond Spren? It was unnatural. Yet somehow their bond was more powerful than ours. I always said the same thing, and believe it even more strongly now. We must exterminate them." Our people will never be safe on this world as long as the humans exist.
Venli felt her mouth grow dry. Distantly, she heard a rhythm. The rhythm of the lost? An inferior one. It was gone in a moment. Ryan hummed to conceit, then turned and barked a command to the crazy fused. She scrambled to her feet and loped after him as he floated out the door. He was probably going to confer with the town's spren. He'd give orders and warnings, which he usually only did right before they left one town for another. Despite having unpacked her things, working under the assumption she'd be here for the night, now Venli suspected they would soon be moving on. She went to her room on the second floor of the mansion. As usual, the luxury of these buildings astounded her. Soft beds you felt you would sink into. Fine woodworking, blown glass vases, and crystal sconces on the walls for holding spheres. She'd always hated the Alethi, who had acted like they were benevolent parents encountering wild children to be educated. They had pointedly ignored the culture and advancements of Venli's people, eyeing only the hunting grounds of the Great Shells that they, because of translation errors, decided must be the listener's gods. Venli felt at the beautiful swirls in the glass of a wall sconce. How had they colored some of it white, but not all of it? Whenever she encountered things like this, she had to remind herself forcefully that the Alethi being technologically superior did not make them culturally superior. They'd simply had access to more resources. Now that the singers had access to art form, they would be able to create works like this too. But still, it was so beautiful. Could they really exterminate the people who had created such beautiful and delicate swirls in the glass? The decorations reminded her of her own pattern of marbling. The pouch at her waist started vibrating. She wore a listener's leather skirt below a tight shirt, topped with a looser overshirt. Part of Venli's place was to show the singers that someone like them, not some distant, fearsome creature from the past, had brought the storms and freed the singers. Her eyes lingered on the sconce, and then she dumped out her pouch on the room's stumpweight desk. Spheres bounced free, along with a larger number of uncut gemstones, which her people had used instead. The little spren rose from where it had been hiding among the light. It looked like a comet when it moved, though sitting still as it did now, it only glowed like a spark.
"Are you one of them?" she asked softly. "The spren that move in the sky some nights?"
It pulsed, sending off a ring of light that dissipated like glowing smoke. Then it began zipping through the room, looking at things.
"The room isn't any different from the last one you looked at," she said to amusement.
The spren zipped to the wall sconce where it let off a pulse in awe, then moved to the identical one on the opposite side of the door. Venli moved to gather her clothing and writings from the drawers in the dresser.
"I don't know why you stay with me. It can't be comfortable in that bag."
The spren zipped past her, looking in the drawer that she'd opened.
"It's a drawer," she said.
The spren peeked out, then pulsed in a quick blinking succession.
"That's curiosity," she thought,
recognizing the rhythm. She hummed it to herself as she packed her things, then hesitated. Curiosity was an old rhythm, like amusement, which she'd attuned moments ago. She could hear the normal rhythms again. She looked at the little spren.
"Is this your doing?" she demanded to irritation.
It shrank, but pulsed to resolve.
"What are you hoping to accomplish? Your kind betrayed us. Go find a human to bother."
It shrank further, then pulsed to resolve again. Bother. Down below, the door slammed open. Ryan was back already.
"In the pouch," she hissed to command. "Quickly."
Interlude 8. Mem.
There was art, to doing laundry. Sure, everyone knew the basics, just like every child could hum a tune. But did they know how to relax the fibers of a stubborn sea silk dress by returning it to a warm brine, then restore its natural softness by rinsing it and brushing with the grain? Could they spot the difference between a mineral dye from Azier and a floral dye from the Vaden slopes? You use different soaps for each one. Mem toiled at her canvas, which was in this case a pair of vivid red trousers. She scooped some powder soap, hog fat based, mixed with fine abrasive, and rubbed at a stain on the leg. She wetted the trousers again, then with a fine brush she worked in the soap. Oil stains were challenging enough, but this man had gotten blood on the same spot. She had to get the stain out without fading that fine Michelin red. They got it from a slug on the shores of the Pure Lake, or ruining the cloth. Moraes did like his clothing to look sharp. Mem shook her head. What was this stain? She had to go through 4 soaps, then try some of her drying powder before she got it to budge, and then she moved on to the rest of the suit. Hours passed. Clean this spot, rinse that shirt, hang it up for all to see. She didn't notice the time until the other Vaden washwomen started to leave in clumps, returning to their homes, some of which were empty and cold, their husbands and sons dead in the Civil War. The need for clean clothing outlived disasters. The end of the world could come, but that would only mean more bloodstains to wash. Mem finally stepped back before her drying racks, hands on hips, basking in the accomplishment of a day's work well done. Drying her hands, Mem went to check on her new assistant, Palm, who was washing underclothes. The dark-skinned woman was obviously of mixed blood, both Easterner and Westerner. She was finishing an undershirt and didn't say anything as Mem stepped up beside her. Storms, why hasn't anyone snatched her up? Mem thought, as the gorgeous woman rubbed the shirt, then dunked it, then rubbed it again. Women like Palm didn't usually end up as wash girls, though she did tend to stare daggers at any man who got too close. Maybe that was it. Well done, Mem said. Hang that to dry and help me gather the rest of this. They piled clothing in baskets, then made the short hike through the city. Vaidenar still smelled like smoke to Mem. Not the good smoke of bakeries, but rather of the enormous pyres that had burned outside on the plain. Her employer lived near the markets, in a large townhome beside some rubble, a lingering reminder of when siege weapons had rained boulders upon Vaidenar. The two washwomen passed guards at the front and headed up the steps. Mem insisted on not using the servants' entrance. Moraes was one of the few who humored her. "Keep close," she said to Palm, who dallied once they were inside. They hurried down a long, unornamented corridor, then up a staircase. People said that servants were invisible. Mem had never found that to be true, particularly around people like Moraes. Not only did the house steward notice if someone so much as moved a candlestick, Moraes's friends were the type who kept careful track of everyone near them. 2 of them stood in a doorway Mem passed, a man and a woman speaking quietly. Both wore swords, and though they didn't interrupt their conversation as the washwomen passed, they watched. Moraes's quarters were at the top of a staircase. He wasn't there today. He appeared on occasion to drop off dirty clothing, then gallivanted off someplace to find new types of creme to stain his shirts. Mem and Palm went into his den first. He kept his evening jackets there. Palm froze in the doorway. "Stop dallying," Mem reminded her, covering a smile. After stark, empty hallways and stairwells, this overstuffed den was a little overwhelming. She'd marveled, too, her first time here. A mantle covered in curiosities, each in its own glass display. Deep rugs from Marat. 5 paintings of the finest skill, each of a different herald. "You are right,"
Palm said from behind. Of course I was right, Mem said, setting down her basket in front of the corner wardrobe. Marais, remember he doesn't want to be called master, is of the finest and most refined taste. He employs only the best of... She was interrupted by a ripping sound. It was a sound that inspired terror. The sound of a seam splitting, or of a delicate chemise tearing as it caught on part of a washtub. It was the sound of disaster incarnate. Mem turned to find her new assistant standing on a chair, attacking one of Marais's paintings with a knife. A piece of Mem's brain stopped working. A whine escaped from the back of her throat, and her vision grew dark. She was destroying one of Marais's paintings.
I've been looking for that, Palm said, stepping back and putting hands on hips, still standing on the chair.
Two guards burst into the room, perhaps drawn by the noise. They looked at Palm and their jaws dropped. In turn, she flipped her knife about in her hand and pointed it threateningly at the men. Then, horror of horrors, Marais himself appeared behind the soldiers, wearing an evening jacket and slippers.
What is this ruckus?
So refined. Yes, his face looked like it had seen the wrong side of a sword a couple of times, but he had exquisite taste in clothing, and, of course, in garment care professionals.
Ah, he said, noticing Palm. Finally. The masterpiece of the oil sworn was all it took, was it? Excellent.
Marais shoved out the confused guards, then pulled the door shut. He didn't even seem to notice Mem.
Ancient one, would you care for something to drink?
Palm narrowed her eyes at him, then hopped off the chair. She walked quickly to Marais and used one hand on his chest to push him aside. She pulled open the door.
I know where Talon Elot is, Marais said.
Palm froze.
Yes. Let's have that drink, shall we? Marais asked. My Babsk has been eager to speak with you.
He glanced at Mem.
Is that my Azish cavalry lord's suit?
Yes.
You got the aether out of it?
What?
He strolled over and pulled the red trousers out of the basket to inspect them.
Mem, you are an absolute genius. Not every hunter carries a spear, and this is proof indeed. Go to Condwish and tell him I approve a 3-firemark bonus for you.
Thank you, Marais.
Go collect your bonus and leave, Marais said. Note that you will need to find a new wash girl to help you after today.
Interlude 9. True Labor Begins.
Esh and I would have loved this, Venli thought, as she flew hundreds of feet in the air.
Rhine and the other fused carried her by means of linked harnesses. It made her feel like a sack of grain being hauled to market, but it gave her quite an amazing view. Endless hills of stone, patches of green, often in the shadows of hillsides, thick forests snarled with undergrowth to present a unified front against the storms.
Esh and I would have been thrilled.
She'd have begun drawing maps, talking about the places she could go. Venli, on the other hand, spent most of these trips feeling sick to her stomach. Normally she didn't have to suffer for long. Towns were close together here in Alethkar. Yet today her ancestors flew her past many occupied towns, without stopping. Eventually, what first appeared to be another ridge of stones resolved into the walls of a large city, easily twice the size of one of the domes at the Shattered Plains. Stone buildings and reinforced towers. Marvels and wonders. It had been years since she'd seen Kolinar, only that once, when they'd executed King Gavilar. Now smoke rose in patches throughout the city, and many of the guard towers had been shattered. The city gates lay broken.
Kolinar, it seemed, had been conquered. Rhein and his companions zipped through the air, raising fists toward other fused. They surveyed the city, then soared out beyond the wall and landed near a bunker outside the city. They waited as Venli undid her harness, then lifted into the air again just high enough that the bottoms of their long cloaks brushed the stones.
"Am I finished with my work, Ancient One?" Venli asked to subservience. "Is that why you finally brought me here?"
"Done," Rhein said to ridicule. "Child, you haven't even begun. Those little villages were practice. Today your true labor begins."
Interlude 10. Sheeler. "You have three choices," the Herdazian general said. He had dark brown skin, the color of a weathered stone, and there was a hint of gray in the thin mustache on his upper lip. He stepped up to Sheeler, then put his hands to his sides. Remarkably, some men affixed manacles to the general's own wrists. "What on Roshar?" "Pay attention," the general said. "This is important." "To the manacles," Sheeler said in Herdazian. Life on the border had forced him to learn the language. "What is going on here? Do you realize the trouble you're in for taking me captive?" Sheeler started to stand, but one of the Herdazian soldiers forced him down so hard his knees rapped against the hard stone floor of the tent. "You have three choices." The general's manacles clinked as he twisted his hands in them. "First, you can choose the sword. Now that might be a clean death. A good beheading rarely hurts. Unfortunately, it won't be a headsman who gets the chance with you. We'll give the sword to the women you abused. Each gets a hack, one after another. How long it goes on will depend on them." "This is outrageous," Sheeler said. "I'm a Light Eyes of the Fifth Dawn. I'm cousin to the High Lord himself, and..." "Second option," the general said, "is the hammer. We break your legs and arms, then hang you from the cliff by the ocean. You might last until the storm that way, but it will be miserable." Sheeler struggled to no avail. Captured by Herdazians. Their general wasn't even a Light Eyes. The general twisted his hands, then pulled them apart. The manacles clinked to the ground. Nearby, several of his officers grinned while others groaned. A scribe had tapped off the time and gave an accounting of the seconds the escape had taken. The general accepted the applause of several men, then thumped another, a loser in the betting, on his back. Sheeler almost seemed forgotten for a moment. Finally, the general turned back to him.
"I wouldn't take the hammer if I were you, but there's a third option, the hog."
"I demand the right of ransom," Sheeler said. "You must contact my High Prince and accept payment based on my rank."
"Ransom is for men caught in battle," the general said, "not bastards caught robbing and murdering civilians."
"My homeland is under invasion," Sheeler shouted. "I was gathering resources so we might mount a resistance."
"A resistance is not what we caught you mounting." The general kicked at the manacles by his feet. "Choose one of the three options. I don't have all day."
Sheeler licked his lips. How had he ended up in this situation? His homeland gone crazy, the parshmen rampaging, his men scattered by flying monsters? Now this? The dirty Herdazians obviously weren't going to listen to reason. They... Wait.
"Did you say hog?" Sheeler asked.
"It lives down by the shore," the Herdazian general said. "That's your third option. We grease you, and you wrestle the hog. It's fun for the men to watch. They need sport now and then."
"And if I do this, you won't kill me?"
"No, but this isn't as easy as you think. I've tried it myself, so I can speak with authority.
Crazy Herdazians.
I choose the hog. As you wish. The general picked up the manacles and handed them to his officer.
Thought you'd fail these ones for sure, the officer said. The merchant claimed they're from the best Thalen locksmiths. Doesn't matter how good the lock is, Gerano, the general said with a grin, if the cuffs are loose.
What a ridiculous little man. Too wide smile, a flat nose, a missing tooth. Why, High Lord Amaram would have...
Sheila was jerked to his feet by the chains, then pulled through the camp of Herdazian soldiers on the Alethi border. There were more refugees here than actual fighting men. Give Sheila a single company, and he could rout this entire force. His insufferable captors led him down an incline past the cliffs and toward the shore. Soldiers and refugees alike gathered above, jeering and calling. Obviously, the Herdazian general was too frightened to actually kill an Alethi officer, so they would humiliate him by making him wrestle a pig. They'd have a good laugh, then send him away smarting. Idiots. He'd come back with an army. One man locked Sheila's chain to a metal loop on the stones. Another approached with a pitcher of oil. They poured it over Sheila's head. He sputtered as the liquid ran down his face.
What is that stench?
Above, someone blew a horn.
I'd say good luck, boss, the Herdazian soldier told Sheila as his companion ran off. But I've got 3 marks on you, not lost in a full minute. Still, who knows? When the general was chained down here, he got out in less.
The ocean started to churn.
Of course, the soldier said. The general likes this kind of thing. He's a little weird.
The soldier dashed back up the bank, leaving Sheila locked in place, doused in pungent oil and gaping as an enormous claw broke the surface of the ocean. Perhaps the hog was more of a nickname.
Interlude 11. Her Reward. Venli's little spren, whom she'd named Timber, peeked around the room, looking in each corner and shadowed place, like she did each time Venli let her out of the pouch. Days had passed since Venli had first arrived at Kolinar, and as Rhein had warned, this was her true labor. Venli now gave her presentation a dozen times each day, speaking to groups of singers brought out of the city for the purpose. She wasn't allowed into Kolinar herself. They kept her sequestered in this storm shelter outside, which they called the Hermitage. Venli hummed to spite as she leaned against the window, annoyed by the incarceration. Even the window had only been installed, cut by a shard blade and set with thick storm shutters, after her repeated requests. The city outside called to her. Majestic walls, beautiful buildings. It reminded her of Narak, which actually her people hadn't built. In living there, the listeners had profited from the labors of ancient humans, as modern humans had profited from the enslaved singers. Timber floated over to her, then hovered by the window, as if to sneak out and look around outside. No, Venli said. Timber pulsed to resolve, then inched forward in the air. Stay inside, Venli said to command. They're watching for spren like you. Descriptions of your kind and others have been spread all through the city. The little spren backed away, pulsing to annoyance, before settling in the air beside Venli. Venli rested her head on her arms. I feel like a relic, she whispered. Already I seem like a cast-off ruin from a nearly forgotten day. Are you the reason I feel like that suddenly? I only get this way when I let you out. Timber pulsed to peace. Upon hearing that, something stirred deep within Venli, the void spren that occupied her gem heart. That spren couldn't think, not like Ulim or the higher void spren. It was a thing of emotions and animal instincts, but the bond with it granted Venli her form of power. She started to wonder. So many of the fused were obviously unhinged,
Perhaps their inordinately long lives had taken a toll on their psyches. Wouldn't Odium need new leaders for his people? If she proved herself, could she claim a place among them? New fused. New gods? Esh and I had always worried about Venli's thirst for power, and had cautioned her to control her ambitions. Even Demid at times had been worried for her. And now they were all dead. Timber pulsed to peace, then to pleading, then back to peace. I can't, Venli said to mourning. I can't. Pleading, more insistent, the rhythm of the lost, of remembrance, and then pleading. I'm the wrong one, Venli said to annoyance. I can't do this, Timber. I can't resist him. Pleading. I made this happen, she said to Fury. Don't you realize that? I'm the one who caused all this. Don't plead to me. The Spren shrank, her light diminishing, yet she still pulsed to resolve. Idiot Spren. Venli put a hand to her head. Why was she not more angry about what had happened to Demid, Eshenai, and the others? Could Venli really think about joining the Fused? Those monsters insisted her people were gone and rebuffed her questions about the thousands of listeners who had survived the Battle of Narok. Were they all being turned into Fused? Shouldn't Venli be thinking about that? Not her ambitions? A form changes the way you think, Venli. Everyone knew that. Esh and I had lectured incessantly, as had been her way, about not letting the form dictate one's actions. Control the form, don't let it control you. But then Esh and I had been exemplary. A general and a hero, Esh and I had done her duty. All Venli had ever wanted was power. Timber suddenly pulsed with a flash of light and zipped away under the bed, terrified. Ah, Venli said to mourning, looking past the city at the sudden darkening of the sky. The Everstorm. It came about every 9 days, and this was the second since her arrival. So that's why they didn't bring an evening batch to listen to me. She folded her arms, took a deep breath, and hummed to resolve until she lost track and shifted unconsciously to the rhythm of destruction. She didn't close the window. He didn't like that. Instead, she closed her eyes and listened to the thunder. Lightning flashed beyond her eyelids, red and garish. The Spren in her leaped to feel it, and she grew excited, the rhythm of destruction swelling inside her. Her people might be gone, but this power was worth it. How could she not embrace this? How long can you keep being two people, Venli? She seemed to hear Eshenai's voice. How long will you vacillate? The storm hit, wind blasting through the window, lifting her, and she entered some kind of vision. The building vanished, and she was tossed about in the storm. But she knew that after it passed, she wouldn't be hurt. Venli eventually dropped onto a hard surface. She hummed to destruction and opened her eyes, finding herself standing on a platform hanging high in the sky, far above Roshar, which was a blue and brown globe below. Behind her was a deep black nothingness, marred only by a tiny blip that could have been a single star. That yellow-white star expanded toward her at an awesome speed, swelling, growing, until it overwhelmed her with an incredible flame. She felt her skin melting, her flesh burning away.
"You are not telling the story well enough," Odium's voice declared, speaking the ancient tongue. "You grow restless. The Fused inform me of it. This will change, or you will be destroyed."
Yes, Lord.
speaking burned away her tongue. She could no longer see. The fire had claimed her eyes. Pain, agony. But she couldn't bend to it, for the god before her demanded all of her attention. The pain of her body being consumed was nothing compared to him.
"You are mine. Remember this."
She was vaporized completely. And woke on the floor of her hermitage, fingers bleeding from having clawed the stone again. The storm's rumbling had grown distant. She'd been gone for hours. Had she burned the entire time? Trembling, she squeezed her eyes shut, her skin melting, her eyes, her tongue burning away. The rhythm of peace pulled her out of it, and she knew Timber hovered beside her. Venli rolled over and groaned, eyes still shut, seeking peace in her own mind. She couldn't find it. Odium's presence was too fresh. The spren inside her thrummed to craving instead. "I can't do it," she whispered to derision. "You've got the wrong sister." The wrong sister had died. The wrong sister lived. Venli had schemed to return their gods. This was her reward.
Part 4. Defy. Sing Beginnings. Adolin, Shallan, Kaladin, Dalinar, Navani, Zeth, Taravangian, Venli. 88. Voices. 8 years ago. Gavilar was starting to look worn. Dalinar stood at the back of the king's den, listening with half an ear. The king spoke with the heirs of the high princes, staying to safe topics, like Gavilar's plans for various civic projects in Kolinar. "He's looking so old," Dalinar thought. "Gray before his time. He needs something to revitalize him. A hunt, maybe?" Dalinar didn't need to participate in the meeting. His job was to loom. Occasionally, one of the younger men would glance toward the perimeter of the room and see the blackthorn there in shadow, watching. He saw fires reflected in their eyes and heard the weeping of children in the back of his mind. "Don't be weak," Dalinar thought. "It's been almost 3 years." 3 years, living with what he'd done. 3 years wasting away in Kolinar. He'd assumed it would get better. It was only getting worse. Sadius had carefully spun news of the rift's destruction to the king's advantage. He'd called it regrettable that the rifters had forced Kolin action by killing Dalinar's wife, and named it unfortunate that the city had caught fire during the fighting. Gavilar had publicly censured Dalinar and Sadius for losing the city to flames, but his denunciation of the rifters had been far more biting. The implication was clear. Gavilar didn't want to unleash the Blackthorn. Even he couldn't predict what kind of destruction Dalinar would bring. Obviously, such measures were a last resort, and these days everyone was careful to give him plenty of other options. So efficient. All it had cost was one city, and possibly Dalinar's sanity. Gavilar suggested to the gathered light eyes that they light a fire in the hearth for warmth. Well, that was the signal that he could leave. Dalinar could not stand fire. The scent of smoke smelled like burning skin, and the crackling of flames reminded him only of her. Dalinar slipped out the back door, stepping into a hallway on the third floor, heading toward his own rooms. He had moved himself and his sons into the royal palace. His own keep reminded him too much of her. Storms. Standing in that room looking at the fear in the eyes of Gavilar's guests had made the pain and memories particularly acute today. He was better on some days. Others felt like today. He needed a stiff drink from his wine cabinet. Unfortunately, as he rounded through the curved corridor, he smelled incense in the air. Coming from his rooms? Anarn was burning it again. Dalinar pulled up as if he'd run up against something solid, then turned on his heel and walked away.
It was too late, unfortunately. That scent, that was her scent. He strode down to the second floor, passing blood-red carpets, pillared hallways. Where to get something to drink? He couldn't go out into the city where people acted so terrified of him. The kitchens? No, he wouldn't go begging to one of the palace chefs, who would in turn tiptoe to the king and whisper that the Blackthorn had been at the Violets again. Gavilar complained at how much Dalinar drank, but what else did soldiers do when not at war? Didn't he deserve a little relaxation after all he'd done for this kingdom? He turned toward the king's throne room, which, as the king was using his den instead, would be empty today. He went in through the servants' entrance and stepped into a small staging room where food was prepared before being delivered to the king. Using a sapphire sphere for light, Dalinar knelt and rummaged in one of the cupboards. Usually they kept some rare vintages here for impressing visitors. The cupboards were empty. Damnation. He found nothing but pans, trays, and cups. A few bags of Herdazian spices. He fumed, tapping the counter. Had Gavilar discovered that Dalinar was coming here and moved the wine? The king thought him a drunkard, but Dalinar indulged only on occasion. On bad days. Drink quieted the sounds of people crying in the back of his mind. Weeping. Children burning. Begging their fathers to save them from the flames. And Irby's voice accompanying them all. When was he going to escape this? He was becoming a coward. Nightmares when he tried to sleep, weeping in his mind whenever he saw fire. Storms take Evie for doing this to him. If she'd acted like an adult instead of a child, if she'd been able to face duty or just reality for once, she wouldn't have gotten herself killed. He stomped into the corridor and strode right into a group of young soldiers. They scrambled to the sides of the hallway and saluted. Dalinar tipped his head toward their salutes, trying to keep the thunder from his expression. The consummate general. That was who he was. Father? Dalinar pulled up sharply. He'd completely missed that Adolin was among the soldiers. At 15, the youth was growing tall and handsome. He got the former from Dalinar. Today, Adolin wore a fashionable suit with far too much embroidery and boots that were topped by silver.
That's not a standard-issue uniform, soldier, Dalinar said to him.
I know, Adolin said. I had it specially tailored. Storms. His son was becoming a fop. Father, Adolin said, stepping up and making an eager fist. Did you get my message? I've got a bat set up with Tenethar. Father, he's ranked. It's a step toward winning my blade.
He beamed at Dalinar. Emotions warred inside of Dalinar. Memories of good years spent with his son in Yakaved, riding or teaching him the sword. Memories of her, the woman from whom Adolin had inherited that blonde hair and that smile. So genuine. Dalinar wouldn't trade Adolin's sincerity for 100 soldiers in proper uniforms. But he also couldn't face it right now.
Father? Adolin said.
You're in uniform, soldier. Your tone is too familiar. Is this how I taught you to act?
Adolin blushed, then put on a stronger face. He didn't wilt beneath the stern words. When censured, Adolin only tried harder.
Sir, the young man said, I'd be proud if you'd watch my bout this week. I think you'll be pleased with my performance.
Storming child. Who could deny him?
I'll be there, soldier, and we'll watch with pride.
Adolin grinned, saluted, then dashed back to join the others. Dalinar walked off as quickly as he could to get away from that hair, that wonderful, haunting smile. Well, he needed a drink now more than ever, but he would not go begging to the cooks. He had another option, one that he was certain even his brother, sly though Gavilar was, wouldn't have considered. He went down another set of steps and reached the eastern gallery of the palace, now passing ardents with shaved heads. It was a sign of his desperation that he came all the way out here, facing their condemning eyes. He slipped down the stairwell into the depths of the building, entering halls that led toward the kitchens in one direction, the catacombs in the other. A few twists and turns led him out onto the beggar's porch.
a small patio between the compost heaps and the gardens. Here a group of miserable people waited for the offerings Gavilar gave after dinner. Some begged of Dalinar, but a glare made the rag-clothed wretches pull back and cower. At the back of the porch he found Ehu, huddled in the shadows between two large religious statues, their backs facing the beggars, their hands spread toward the gardens. Ehu was an odd one, even for a crazy beggar. With black, matted hair and a scraggly beard, his skin was dark for an Aleti. His clothing was mere scraps, and he smelled worse than the compost. Somehow, he always had a bottle with him. Ehu giggled at Dalinar.
"Have you seen me?"
"Unfortunately," Dalinar settled on the ground. "I have smelled you, too. What are you drinking today? It better not be water this time, Ehu." Ehu wagged a stout, dark bottle.
"Do you know what it is, little child? Tastes good."
Dalinar tried a sip and hissed. A burning wine, no sweetness to it at all. A white, though he didn't recognize the vintage. Storms, it smelled intoxicating. Dalinar took a chug, then handed the bottle back to Ehu. "How are the voices?"
"Soft today. They chant about ripping me apart, eating my flesh, drinking my blood."
"Pleasant."
"Hee-hee."
Ehu snuggled back against the branches of the hedge wall, as if they were soft silk.
"Nice. Not bad at all, little child. What of your noises?"
In reply, Dalinar reached out his hand. Ehu gave him the bottle. Dalinar drank, welcoming the fuzzing of mind that would quiet the weeping.
"Aven bega," Ehu said. "It's a fine night for my torment, and no telling the skies to be still. Where is my soul, and who is this in my face?"
"You're a strange little man, Ehu." Ehu cackled his response and waved for the wine. After a drink, he returned it to Dalinar, who wiped off the beggar's spittle with his shirt. Storm Gavilar for pushing him to this.
"I like you," Ehu said to Dalinar. "I like the pain in your eyes. Friendly pain. Companionable pain."
"Thanks."
"Which one got you, little child?" Ehu asked. "The black fisher? The spawning mother? The faceless? Moalach is close. I can hear his wheezing, his scratching, his scraping at time like a rat breaking through walls."
"I have no idea what you're talking about."
"Madness,"
Ehu said, then giggled.
"I used to think it wasn't my fault, but you know, we can't escape what we did. We let them in. We attracted them, befriended them, took them out to dance and courted them. It is our fault. You open yourself to it and you pay the price. They ripped my brain out and made it dance. I watched."
Dalinar paused, the bottle halfway to his lips. Then he held it out to Ehu.
"Drink this. You need it."
Ehu obliged. Sometime later, Dalinar stumbled back to his rooms, feeling downright serene, thoroughly smashed and without a crying child to be heard. At the door, he stopped and looked back down the corridor. Where? He couldn't remember the trip back up from the beggar's porch. He looked down at his unbuttoned jacket, his white shirt stained with dirt and drink. A voice drifted through the closed door. Was that Adolin inside? Dalinar started, then focused. Storms, he'd come to the wrong door. Another voice. Was that Gavilar? Dalinar leaned in. "I'm worried about him, Uncle," Adolin's voice said.
"Your father never adjusted to being alone, Adolin," the king replied. "He misses your mother." Idiots, Dalinar thought. He didn't miss Evie. He wanted to be rid of her. Though he did ache now that she was gone.
Was that why she wept for him so often? "He's down with the beggars again," another voice said from inside. Elokar? That little boy? Why did he sound like a man? He was only... how old? He tried the serving room again first. Seems he forgot he drank that all last time. Honestly, if there's a bottle hidden in this palace anywhere, that drunken fool will find it. "My father is not a fool," Adolin said. "He's a great man, and you owe him your..."
"Peace, Adolin," Gavilar said. "Both of you, hold your tongues. Dalinar is a soldier. He'll fight through this. Perhaps if we go on a trip, we can distract him from his loss. Maybe Aesir?"
Their voices. He had just rid himself of Evie's weeping, but hearing this dragged her back. Dalinar gritted his teeth and stumbled to the proper door. Inside, he found the nearest couch and collapsed.
Map. A portion of the Sea of Lost Lights. My personal map of the requested area, including notes from previous errands. Top left, Candlemore. I rode that Mandra from here to Celebrant, so you owe me those silver pieces after all. Top right, Kolinar's location in the physical realm. Lower than that, Smolderbrand Channel. I met Smolderbrand, stole this map from her. To the left and below that, the city of Celebrant. Middle left, Ravidzath. Spren fishing is illegal here, but their jail is nicer than most. Lower right, Caretaker of Laughter, avoid at all costs. Lower left, Balan City's location in the physical realm. I hate the lake that corresponds to Thalina's second largest island.
89. Damnation. My research into the Unmade has convinced me that these things were not simply spirits of the void or nine shadows who moved in the night. They were each a specific kind of spren endowed with vast powers. From Hesse's Mythica, page 3. Adolin had never bothered imagining what damnation might look like. Theology was for women and scribes. Adolin figured he'd try to follow his calling, becoming the best swordsman he could. The Ardents told him that was enough, that he didn't need to worry about things like damnation. Yet here he was, kneeling on a white marble platform with a black sky overhead, a cold sun, if it could even be called that, hanging at the end of a roadway of clouds. An ocean of shifting glass beads clattering against one another. Tens of thousands of flames, like the tips of oil lamps, hovering above that ocean. And the spren. Terrible, awful spren swarmed in the ocean of beads, bearing a multitude of nightmare forms. They twisted and writhed, howling with inhuman voices. He didn't recognize any of the varieties. "I'm dead," Adolin whispered. "We're dead. And this is damnation. But what of the pretty blue-white spren girl? The creature with the stiff robe and a mesmerizing impossible symbol instead of a head? What of the woman with the scratched-out eyes? And those two enormous spren standing overhead with spears and..." Light exploded to Adolin's left. Kaladin Stormblast, pulling in power, floated into the air. Beads rattled and every monster in the writhing throng turned, as if one to fixate upon Kaladin. "Kaladin!" the spren girl shouted. "Kaladin, they feed on Stormlight. You'll draw their attention. Everything's attention." "Drey and Scar," Kaladin said. "Our soldiers. Where are they?" "They're still on the other side," Shallan said, standing up beside Adolin. The creature with the twisted head took her arm, steadying her. "Storms, they might be safer than we are. We're in Shadesmar." Some of the lights nearby vanished, candles' flames being snuffed out. Many spren swam toward the platform, joining an increasingly large group that churned around it, causing a ruckus in the beads. The majority of them were long eel-like things with ridges along their backs and purple antennae that squirmed like tongues and seemed to be made of thick liquid. Beneath them, deep in the beads, something enormous shifted, causing beads to roll off one another in piles.
"Kaladin," the blue girl shouted, "please!"
He looked at her, and seemed to see her for the first time. The light vanished from him, and he dropped, hard, to the platform. Azure held her thin shard blade, gaze fixed on the things swimming through the beads around their platform. The only one who didn't seem frightened was the strange Spren woman with the scratched-out eyes and the skin made of rough cloth. Her eyes, they weren't empty sockets. Instead, she was like a portrait where the eyes had been scraped off. Adolin shivered. "So," he said, "any idea what is happening?"
"We're not dead," Azure growled. "They call this place Shadesmar. It's the realm of thought."
"I peek into this place when I soulcast," Shallan said. "Shadesmar overlaps the real world, but many things are inverted here."
"I passed through it when I first came to your land about a year ago," Azure added. "I had guides then, and I tried to avoid looking at too much crazy stuff."
"Smart," Adolin said. He put his hand to the side to summon his own shard blade. The woman with the scratched eyes stretched her head toward him in an unnatural way, then screeched with a loud, piercing howl. Adolin stumbled away, nearly colliding with Shallan and her spren? Was that Pattern?
"That is your sword,"
Pattern said in a perky voice. He had no mouth that Adolin could see.
"She is quite dead. I don't think you can summon her here."
He cocked his bizarre head, looking at Azure's blade.
"Yours is different. Very curious."
The thing deep beneath their platform shifted again.
"That is probably bad," Pattern noted. "Yes. Those spren above us are the souls of the Oathgate, and that one deep beneath us is likely one of the Unmade. It must be very large on this side."
"So what do we do?"
Shallan asked. Pattern looked in one direction, then the other.
"No boat. Yes, that is a problem, isn't it?"
Adolin spun around. Some of the eel-like spren climbed onto the platform using stumpy legs that Adolin had missed earlier. Those long purple antennae stretched toward him, wiggling. Fear spren, he realized. Fear spren were little globs of purple goo that looked exactly like the tips of those antennae.
"We need to get off this platform," Shallan said. "Everything else is secondary. Kaladin?"
She trailed off as she glanced toward him. The bridgeman knelt on the stone, head bowed, shoulders slumped. Storms. Adolin had been forced to carry him away from the battle, numb and broken. Looked like that emotion had caught up to him again. Kaladin's spren, Adolin could only guess that was the identity of the pretty girl in blue, stood beside him, one hand resting protectively on his back.
"Kaladin's not well,"
she said.
"I have to be well,"
Kaladin said, his voice hoarse as he climbed back to his feet. His long hair fell across his face, obscuring his eyes. Storms. Even surrounded by monsters, the bridgeman could look intimidating.
"How do we get to safety? I can't fly us without attracting attention."
"This place is the inverse of your world," Azure said.
She stepped back from a long antenna exploring in her direction.
"Where there are larger bodies of water on Roshar, we will have land here, correct?"
Pattern said, nodding. "The river?" Adolin asked. He tried to orient himself, looking past the thousands of floating lights.
"There."
He pointed at a lump he could barely spot in the distance, like a long island. Kaladin stared at it, frowning.
"Can we swim in these beads?"
"No," Adolin said, remembering what it had felt like to fall into this ocean. The beads rattled and clacked against one another as the large thing surged beneath. In the near distance, a single spire of rock broke the surface, tall and black. It emerged like a mountain peak, slowly lifting from the sea, beads rattling in waves around it. As it grew to the height of a building, a joint appeared. Storms, it wasn't a spire or a mountain, it was a claw. More emerged in other directions. An enormous hand was reaching slowly upward through the glass beads. Deep beneath them, a heartbeat began sounding, rattling the beads. Adolin stumbled back, horrified, and nearly slipped into the bead ocean. He kept his balance, barely, and found himself face to face with a woman with scratches for eyes. She stared at him, completely emotionless, as if waiting for him to try to summon his shard blade so she could scream again. Damnation. No matter what Azure said, he was certainly in damnation.
"What do I do?" Shallan whispered. She knelt on the white stone of the platform, searching among the beads. Each gave her an impression of an object in the physical realm, a dropped shield, a vase from the palace, a scarf. Nearby, hundreds of little spren, like little orange or green people only a few inches tall, were climbing among the spheres. She ignored those, searching for the soul of something that would help.
"Shallan," Pattern said, kneeling. I don't think soul casting will accomplish anything. It will change an object in the other realm, but not here.
What can I do here? Those spines or claws or whatever rose around them, inevitable, deadly. Pattern hummed, hands clasped before him. His fingers were too smooth, as if they were chiseled of obsidian. His head shifted and changed, going through its sequence. The spherical mass was never the same, yet somehow still always felt like him.
"My memory," he said. "I don't remember."
Stormlight, Shallan thought. Yasna had told her to never enter Shadesmar without Stormlight. Shallan pulled a sphere from her pocket. She still wore Vale's outfit. The beads nearby reacted, trembling and rolling toward her.
"Mmm," Pattern said. "Dangerous."
"I doubt staying here will be better," Shallan said. She sucked in a little Stormlight, only one mark's worth. As before, the Spren didn't seem to notice her use of Stormlight, as much as they had Kaladin's. She rested her free hand against the surface of the ocean. Beads stopped rolling, and instead clicked together beneath her hand. When she pushed down, they resisted. Good first step, she thought, drawing in more Stormlight. The beads pressed around her hand, gathering, rolling onto one another. She cursed, worried that she'd soon just have a big pile of beads.
"Shallan," Pattern said, poking at one of the beads. "Perhaps this?"
It was the soul of the shield she'd felt earlier. She moved the sphere to her gloved safe hand, then pressed her other hand to the ocean. She used that bead's soul as a guide, much like she used a memory as a guide for doing a sketch. And the other beads obediently rolled together and locked into place, forming an imitation of the shield. Pattern stepped out onto it, then jumped up and down happily. Her shield held him without sinking, though he seemed as heavy as an ordinary person. Good enough. Now she just needed something big enough to hold them all. Preferably, as she considered, two somethings. "You, Sword Lady," Shallan said, pointing at Azure. "Help me over here. Adolin, you too. Kaladin, see if you can brood this place into submission." Azure and Adolin hurried over. Kaladin turned, frowning. "What?" "Don't think about that haunted look in his eyes," Shallan thought. "Don't think about what you've done in bringing us here, or how it happened. Don't think, Shallan." Her mind went blank, like it did in preparation for drawing, then locked onto her task. "Find a way out. Everybody," she said. "Those flames are the souls of people, while these spheres represent the souls of objects. Yes, there are huge philosophical implications in that. Let's try to ignore them, shall we? When you touch a bead, you should be able to sense what it represents." Azure sheathed her shard blade and knelt,
feeling at the spheres. I can... Yes. There's an impression to each one.
We need the soul of something long and flat. Shallan plunged her hands into the spheres, eyes closed, letting the impressions wash over her.
I can't sense anything, Adolin said. What am I doing wrong?
He sounded overwhelmed, but don't think about that. Look, fine clothing that hadn't been taken out of its trunk in a long, long time, so old that it saw the dust as part of itself. Withering fruit that understood its purpose, decompose, and stick its seeds to the rock, where they could hopefully weather storms long enough to sprout and gain purchase. Swords recently swung and glorying in their purpose fulfilled. Other weapons belonged to dead men. Blades that had the faintest inkling that they'd failed, somehow. Living souls bobbed around, a swarm of them entering the Oathgate control chamber. One brushed Shallan. Dre, the bridge man. For a brief moment she felt what it was like to be him. Worried for Kaladin. Panicked that nobody was in charge, that he would have to take command. He wasn't a commander. You couldn't be a rebel if you were in charge. He liked being told what to do. That way he could find a method to do it with style. Dre's worries caused her own to bubble up. The Bridgeman's powers will fade without Kaladin, she thought. What of Vatha, Red, and Ishna? I didn't focus. Something reached out from the back of her mind, grabbed those thoughts and feelings, and yanked them into the darkness. Gone. She brushed a bead with her fingers. A large door, like a keep's gate. She grabbed the sphere and shifted it to her safe hand. Unfortunately, the next bead she touched was the palace itself. Momentarily stunned by the majesty of it, Shallan gaped. She held the entire palace in her hand. Too large, she dropped it and kept searching. Trash that still saw itself as a child's toy. A goblet that had been made from melted down nails, taken from an old building. There! She seized hold of a sphere and pressed stormlight into it. A building rose before her, made entirely out of beads. A copy of the Oathgate control building. She managed to make its top rise only a few feet above the surface, most of the building sinking into the depths. The rooftop was in reach. On top of it! She shouted. She held the replica in place as Pattern scrambled onto the roof. Adolin followed, trailed by that ghostly Spren and Azure. Finally, Kaladin picked up his pack and walked with his Spren onto the rooftop. Shallan joined them with the aid of a hand from Adolin. She clutched the sphere that was the soul of the building and tried to make the bead structure move through the sea like a raft. It resisted, sitting there motionless. Well, she had another plan. She scurried to the other side of the roof and stretched down, held by Pattern, to touch the sea again. She used the soul of the large door to make another standing platform. Pattern jumped down, followed by Adolin and Azure. Once they'd all piled precariously on the door, Shallan let go of the building. It crashed down behind them, beads falling in a tumult, frightening some of the little green spren crawling among the beads nearby. Shallan reconstructed the building on the other side of the door with only the rooftop showing. They filed across. They progressed like that, following building with door and door with building, inching toward that distant land. Each iteration took stormlight, though she could reclaim some from each creation before it collapsed. Some of the eel-like spren with the long antennae followed them, curious, but the rest of the varieties, and there were dozens, let them pass without much notice.
Pattern said. Much emotion on the other side. Yes, this is good. It distracts them.
The work was tiring and tedious, but step by step, Shallan moved them away from the frothing mess of the city of Kolinar. They passed the frightened lights of souls, the hungry Spren, who feasted on the emotions from the other side.
"Mmm," Pattern whispered to her. "Look, Shallan. The lights of souls are no longer disappearing. People must be surrendering in Kolinar. I know you do not like the destruction of your own."
That was good, but not unexpected. The Parshmen had never massacred civilians. Though she couldn't say for certain what happened to Azure's soldiers, she hoped fervently they were able to either escape or surrender. Shallan had to edge her group frighteningly close to two of the spines that had emerged from the depths. Those gave no sign of having noticed them. Beyond, they reached a calmer space, out among the beads, a place where the only sound came from the clacking of glass.
"She corrupted them," Kaladin Spren whispered.
Shallan took a break, wiping her brow with a handkerchief from her satchel. They were distant enough that the lights of souls in Kolinar were just a general haze of light.
"What was that, Spren?" Azure asked. "Corrupted?"
"That's why we're here. The Oathgate. Do you remember those two Spren in the sky? Those two are the Gateway's soul. But the red coloring, they must be his now. That's why we ended up here instead of going to Urethiru."
Ja'anat, Shallan thought, said she was supposed to kill us, but that she'd try not to. Shallan wiped her brow again, then got back to work.
Adolin felt useless. All his life he had understood. He'd taken easily to dueling. People naturally seemed to like him. Even in his darkest moment, standing on the battlefield and watching Sadeus's armies retreat, abandoning him and his father, he'd understood what was happening to him. Not today. Today he was just a confused little boy standing in damnation. Today, Adolin Kolin was nothing. He stepped onto another copy of the door. They had to huddle together while Shallan dismissed the rooftop behind, sending it crashing down, then squeezed past everyone to raise another copy of the building. Adolin felt small, so very small. He started toward the rooftop. Kaladin, however, remained standing on the door, staring sightlessly. Syl, his Spren, tugged his hand. "Kaladin?" Adolin asked. Kaladin finally shook himself and gave in to Syl's prodding. He walked onto the rooftop. Adolin followed, then took Kaladin's pack, deliberately but firmly, and swung it over his own shoulder. Kaladin led him. Behind, the doorway shattered back into the ocean of beads. "Hey," Adolin said. "It will be all right." "I survived Bridge 4," Kaladin growled. "I'm strong enough to survive this."
"I'm pretty sure you could survive anything. Storms, Bridge Boy. The Almighty used some of the same stuff he put into shard blades when he made you."
Kaladin shrugged, but as they walked onto the next platform, his expression grew distant again. He stood while the rest of them moved on, almost like he was waiting for their bridge to dissolve and dump him into the sea.
"I couldn't make them see," Kaladin whispered. "I couldn't protect them. I'm supposed to be able to protect people, aren't I?"
"Hey," Adolin said. "You really think that strange Spren with the weird eyes is my sword?" Kaladin started and focused on him, then scowled.
"Yes, Adolin. I thought that was clear."
"I was just wondering."
Adolin glanced over his shoulder and shivered.
"What do you think about this place? Have you ever heard of anything like it?"
"Do you have to talk right now, Adolin?"
"I'm frightened. I talk when I'm frightened."
Kaladin glared at him as if suspecting what Adolin was doing.
"I know little of this place," he finally answered, "but I think it's where Spren are born."
Adolin kept him talking. As Shallan created each new platform, Adolin would lightly touch Kaladin on the elbow or shoulder, and the bridgeman would step forward. Kaladin's Spren hovered nearby, but she let Adolin guide the conversation. Slowly, they approached the strip of land, which turned out to be made of a deep, glassy black stone, kind of like obsidian. Adolin got Kaladin across onto the land, then settled him with his spren. Azure followed, her shoulders sagging. In fact, her hair was fading. It was the strangest thing. Adolin watched it dim from a lethy jet black to a faint gray as she sat down. Must be another effect of this strange place. How much did she know of Shadesmar? He'd been so focused on Kaladin, he hadn't thought to interrogate her. Unfortunately, he was so tired right now, he was having trouble thinking straight. Adolin stepped back onto the platform as Pattern stepped off. Shallan looked as if she was about to collapse. She stumbled, and the platform ruptured. He managed to grab her, and fortunately, they only fell to waist-deep in the beads before their feet touched ground. The little balls of glass seemed to slide and move too easily, not supporting their weight. Adolin had to practically haul Shallan through the tide of beads up onto the bank. There, she toppled backward, groaning and closing her eyes. "Shallan?" he asked, kneeling beside her.
"I'm fine. It just took concentration. Visualization."
"We need to find another way back to our world," Kaladin said, seated nearby. "We can't rest. They're fighting. We need to help them." Adolin surveyed his companions. Shallan lay on the ground, her spren had joined her, lying in a similar posture and looking up at the sky. Azure slumped forward, her small shard blade across her lap. Kaladin continued to stare at nothing with haunted eyes, his spren hovering behind him, worried. "Azure," Adolin said, "is it safe here, on this land?"
"As safe as anywhere in Shadesmar," she said tiredly. "The place can be dangerous if you attract the wrong spren. But there isn't anything we can do about that."
"Then we camp here."
"But,"
Kaladin said. "We camp," Adolin said, gentle but firm. "We can barely stand up straight, bridgeman." Kaladin didn't argue further. Adolin scouted up the bank, though each step felt like it was weighted with stone. He found a small depression in the glassy stone and, with some urging, got the rest of them to move to it. As they made their improvised beds from their coats and packs, Adolin looked one last time at the city, standing witness to the fall of his birthplace. "Storms," he thought. "Elokar. Elokar is dead." Little Gav had been taken and Dalinar was planning to abdicate. Third in line was Adolin himself. King. 90. Reborn. I have done my best to separate fact from fiction, but the two blend like mixing paint when the Voidbringers are involved. Each of the Unmade has a dozen names, and the powers ascribed to them range from the fanciful to the terrifying. From Hesse's Mythica, page 4. Zeth, truthless. Zeth. Just Zeth. Zeth of Shinovar, once called the Assassin in White, had been reborn. Mostly. The Skybreakers whispered of it. Nin, Herald of Justice, had restored him following his defeat in the storm. Like most things, death had not been Zeth's to claim. The Herald had used a type of Fabrial to heal his body before his spirit departed. It had almost taken too long, however. His spirit hadn't properly reattached to his body. Zeth walked with the others out onto the stone field before their small fortress which overlooked the Pure Lake. The air was humid, almost like that of his homeland, though it didn't smell earthy or alive. It smelled of seaweed and wet stone. There were 5 other hopefuls, all of them younger than Zeth. He was shortest among them and the only one who kept his head bald. He couldn't grow a full head of hair, even if he didn't shave it. The other 5 kept their distance from him. Perhaps it was because of the way he left a glowing afterimage when he moved, a sign of his soul's improper reattachment. Not all could see it, but these could.
They were close enough to the surges. Or maybe they feared him because of the black sword in a silver sheath that he wore strapped to his back.
"Oh, it's the lake,"
the sword said in his mind. It had an eager voice that didn't sound distinctly feminine or masculine.
"You should draw me, Zeth. I would love to see the lake. Vasher says there are magic fish here. Isn't that interesting?"
"I have been warned, Sword Nimi," Zeth reminded the weapon, "not to draw you except in the case of extreme emergency, and only if I carry much stormlight, lest you feed upon my soul."
"Well, I wouldn't do that,"
the sword said. It made a huffing sound.
"I don't think you're evil at all, and I only destroy things that are evil."
The sword was an interesting test given him by Nin the Herald, called Nale, Nalan, or Naku by most stonewalkers. Even after weeks of carrying this black sword, Zeth did not understand what the experience was to teach him. The Skybreakers arranged themselves to watch the hopefuls. There were some 50 here, and that didn't count the dozens who were supposedly out on missions. So many! An entire order of Knights Radiant had survived the recreants, and had been watching for the desolation for 2,000 years, constantly replenishing their numbers as others died of old age. Zeth would join them. He would accept their training as Nin had promised him he would receive, then travel to his homeland of Shinobar. There, he would bring justice to the ones who had falsely exiled him. "Do I dare bring them judgment?" a part of him wondered. "Dare I trust myself with the Sword of Justice?" The sword replied,
"You? Zeth, I think you're super trustworthy, and I'm a good judge of people."
"I was not speaking to you, Sword Nimi."
"I know, but you were wrong, and so I had to tell you. Hey, the voices seem quiet today. That's nice, isn't it?"
Mentioning it brought the whispers to Zeth's attention. Nin had not healed Zeth's madness. He'd called it an effect of Zeth's connection to the powers, and said that he was hearing trembles from the spiritual realm, memories of the dead he'd killed. He no longer feared them. He had died and been forced to return. He had failed to join the voices, and now they had no power over him, right? Why, then, did he still weep in the night, terrified? One of the Skybreakers stepped forward. Ki was a golden-haired woman, tall and imposing. Skybreakers clothed themselves in the garb of local lawkeepers, so here, in Marabethia, they wore a patterned shoulder cloak and a colorful skirt-like wrap. Ki wore no shirt, merely a simple cloth tied around her chest.
"Hopefuls," she said in Azish, "you have been brought here because a full Skybreaker has vouched for your dedication and solemnity." "She's boring," the sword said. "Where did Nale go?"
"You said he was boring too, Sword Nimi," Zeth whispered.
"That's true, but interesting things happen around him. We need to tell him that you should draw me more often."
"Your first training has already been completed," Ki said. "You traveled with the Skybreakers and joined them in one of their missions. You have been elevated and deemed worthy of the first ideal. Speak it. You know the words."
"Vasher always drew me," the sword said, sounding resentful.
"Life before death," Zeth said, closing his eyes. "Strength before weakness. Journey before destination." The other 5 belted it out. Zeth whispered it to the voices that called to him from the darkness. Let them see. He would bring justice to those who had caused this. He'd hoped that the first oath would restore his ability to draw upon stormlight, something he had lost along with his previous weapon. However, when he removed a spear from his pocket, he was unable to access the light.
"In speaking this ideal," Ki said,
You are officially pardoned for any past misdeeds or sins. We have paperwork signed by proper authorities for this region. To progress further among our ranks and to learn the lashings, you will need a master to take you as their squire. Then may you speak the second ideal. From there, you will need to impress a high spren and form a bond, becoming a full skybreaker. Today, you will take the first of many tests. Though we will evaluate you, remember that the final measure of your success or failure belongs to the high spren. Do you have any questions?
None of the other hopefuls said anything, so Zeth cleared his throat.
There are 5 ideals, he said. Nin told me of this. You have spoken them all? It's been centuries since anyone mastered the 5th ideal, Key said. One becomes a full skybreaker by speaking the 3rd ideal, the ideal of dedication. We can know what the ideals are?
Zeth asked. For some reason, he'd thought they would be hidden from him.
Of course, Key said. You will find no games here, Zeth, son Naturo. The 1st ideal is the ideal of radiance. You have spoken it. The 2nd is the ideal of justice, an oath to seek and administer justice. The 3rd ideal, the ideal of dedication, requires you to have first bonded a high spren. Once you have, you swear to dedicate yourself to a greater truth, a code to follow. Upon achieving this, you will be taught division, the 2nd and more dangerous of the surges we practice.
Someday, another skybreaker noted, you may achieve the 4th ideal, the ideal of crusade. In this you choose a personal quest and complete it to the satisfaction of your high spren. Once successful, you become a master like ourselves.
Cleanse Shinovar,
Zeth thought. That would be his quest.
What is the 5th ideal?
He asked.
The ideal of law, Key said. It is difficult. You must become law, become truth. As I said, it has been centuries since that was achieved. Nin told me we were to follow the law, something external, as men are changeable and unreliable. How can we become the law?
Law must come from somewhere, another of the Skybreaker Masters said. This is not an oath you will swear, so don't fixate upon it. The 3 will do for most Skybreakers. I was of the 3rd ideal for 2 decades before achieving the 4th. When nobody else asked further questions, experienced Skybreakers began lashing the hopefuls into the air.
What is happening?
Zeth asked.
We will carry you to the place of the test, Key said, as you cannot move with your own stormlight until you swear the 2nd ideal. Do I belong with these youths?
Zeth said.
Nin treated me as something different.
The Herald had taken him on a mission to Tashik, hunting surgebinders from other orders. A heartless act that Nin had explained would prevent the coming of the desolation. Except that it had not. The Everstorm's return had convinced Nin he was wrong. And he'd abandoned Zeth in Tashik. Weeks had passed there until Nin had returned to collect him. The Herald had dropped Zeth here at the fortress, then had vanished into the sky again, this time off to seek guidance.
The Herald, Key said, originally thought that you might skip to the 3rd ideal because of your past. He is no longer here, however, and we cannot judge. You'll have to follow the same path as everyone else.
Zeth nodded. Very well.
No further complaints? Key asked.
It is orderly, Zeth said, and you have explained it well.
Why would I complain?
The others seemed to like this response, and Key herself lashed him into the sky. For a moment he felt the freedom of flight, reminding him of his 1st days, holding an honor blade long ago, before he'd become truthless.
No, you were never truthless. Remember that.
Besides, this flight was not truly his.
He continued falling upward until another skybreaker caught him and lashed him downward, counteracting the first effect and leaving him hovering. A pair of skybreakers took him, one under each arm, and the entire group soared through the air. He couldn't imagine they'd done this sort of thing in the past, as they'd remained hidden for so many years. But they didn't seem to care about secrecy anymore.
"I like it up here," the sword said. "You can see everything."
"Can you actually see things, Sword Nimi?"
"Not like a man. You see all kinds of things, Zeth. Except, unfortunately, how useful I am."
91. Why He Froze. I should point out that although many personalities and motives are ascribed to them, I'm convinced that the Unmade were still Spren. As such, they were as much manifestations of concepts or divine forces as they were individuals. From Hesse's Mythica, page 7. Kaladin remembered cleaning Krem off the bunker floor while in Amaram's army. That sound of chisel on stone reminded Cal of his mother. He knelt on knee pads and scraped at the Krem, which had seeped in under doors and had been tracked in on the boots of soldiers, creating an uneven patina on the otherwise smooth floor. He wouldn't have thought that soldiers would care that the ground wasn't level. Shouldn't he be sharpening his spear or oiling something? Well, in his experience, soldiers spent little time doing soldier things. They instead spent ages walking places, waiting around, or in his case, getting yelled at for walking around or waiting in the wrong places. He sighed as he worked, using smooth, even strokes, like his mother had taught him. Get underneath the Krem and push. You could lift it up in flat sections an inch or more wide. Much easier than chipping at it from above. A shadow darkened the door, and Cal glanced over his shoulder, then hunkered down farther. Great. Sergeant Tux walked to one of the bunks and settled down, the wood groaning under his weight. Younger than the other sergeants, he had features that were off somehow. Perhaps it was his short stature or his sunken cheeks.
"You do that well," Tux said.
Cal continued to work, saying nothing.
"Don't feel so bad, Cal. It's not unusual for a new recruit to pull back. Storms, it's not so uncommon to freeze in battle, let alone on the practice field."
"If it's so common," Cal muttered, "why am I being punished?"
"What, this? A little cleaning duty? Kid, this isn't punishment. This is to help you fit in."
Cal frowned, leaning back and looking up. "Sergeant?"
"Trust me. Everyone was waiting for you to get a dressing down. The longer you went without one, the longer you were going to feel like the odd man out."
"I'm scraping floors because I didn't deserve to be punished?"
"That, and for talking back to an officer."
"He wasn't an officer. He was just a light eyes with—"
"Better to stop that kind of behavior now, before you do it to someone who matters." "Oh, don't glower, Cal. You'll understand eventually."
Cal attacked a particularly stubborn knob of Krem near the leg of a bunk.
"I found your brother," Tux noted. Kaladin's breath caught. "He's in the 7th, Tux said.
"I need to go to him. Can I be transferred? We weren't supposed to be split apart."
"Maybe I can get him moved here to train with you."
"He's a messenger. He's not supposed to train with the spear."
"Everyone trains, even the messenger boys," Tux said.
Cal gripped his chisel tightly, fighting down the urge to stand up and go looking for Tien. Didn't they understand? Tien couldn't hurt Kremlings. He'd catch the things and usher them outside, talking to them like pets. The image of him holding a spear was ludicrous. Tux took out some fathom bark and started chewing. He leaned back on the bunk and put his feet up on the footboard.
"Make sure you get that spot to your left."
Kaladin sighed, then moved to the indicated place.
"Do you want to talk about it?" Tux asked.
The moment when you froze during practice? Stupid Krim. Why did the Almighty make it?
Don't be ashamed, Tux continued. We practice so you can freeze now, instead of when it will get you killed. You face down a squad, knowing they want to kill you, even though they've never met you, and you hesitate, thinking it can't possibly be true. You can't possibly be here preparing to fight, to bleed. Everyone feels that fear.
I wasn't afraid of getting hurt, Cal said softly.
You won't get far if you can't admit to a little fear. Emotion is good. It's what defines us, makes us...
I wasn't afraid of getting hurt. Kaladin took a deep breath. I was afraid of making someone hurt. Tux twisted the bark in his mouth, then nodded.
I see. Well, that's another problem. Not unusual either, but a different matter indeed.
For a time, the only sound in the large barrack was that of chisel on stone.
How do you do it? Cal finally asked, not looking up. How can you hurt people, Tux? They're just poor dark-eyed slobs like us.
I think about my mates, Tux said. I can't let the lads down. My squad is my family now.
So you kill someone else's family?
Eventually, we'll be killing shellheads. But I know what you mean, Cal. It's hard. You'd be surprised how many men look in the face of an enemy and find that they're simply not capable of hurting another person.
Cal closed his eyes, letting the chisel slip from his fingers.
It's good you aren't so eager, Tux said. Means you're sane. I'll take 10 unskilled men with earnest hearts over one callous idiot who thinks this is all a game.
The world doesn't make sense, Cal thought.
His father, a consummate surgeon, told him to avoid getting too wrapped up in his patient's emotions, and here was a career killer telling him to care? Boots scraped on stone as Tux stood up. He walked over and rested one hand on Cal's shoulder.
Don't worry about the war, or even the battle. Focus on your squad mates, Cal. Keep them alive. Be the man they need. He grinned. And get the rest of this floor scraped. I think when you come to dinner, you'll find the rest of the squad more friendly. Just a hunch.
That night, Kaladin discovered that Tux was right. The rest of the men did seem more welcoming now that he'd been disciplined. So Cal held his tongue, smiled, and enjoyed the companionship. He never told Tux the truth. When Cal had frozen on the practice field, it hadn't been out of fear. He'd been very sure he could hurt someone. In fact, he realized that he could kill if needed. And that was what had terrified him. Kaladin sat on a chunk of stone that looked like melted obsidian. It grew right out of the ground in Shadesmar, this place that didn't seem real. The distant sun hadn't shifted in the sky since they'd arrived. Nearby, one of the strange fierce spren crawled along the banks of the sea of glass beads. As big as an axe hound, but longer and thinner, it looked vaguely like an eel with stumpy legs. The purple feelers on its head wiggled and shifted, flowing in his direction. When it didn't sense anything in him that it wanted, it continued along the bank. Syl didn't make any noise as she approached, but he caught sight of her shadow coming up from behind. Like other shadows here, it pointed toward the sun. She sat down on the lump of glass next to him, then thumped her head sideways, resting it on his arm, her hands in her lap.
Others still asleep? Kaladin asked.
Yep. Patterns watching over them.
She wrinkled her nose.
Strange.
He's nice, Syl.
That's the strange part.
She swung her legs out in front of her, barefoot as usual. It seemed odder here on this side, where she was human size. A small flock of spren flew above them, with bulbous bodies, long wings, and flowing tails.
Instead of a head, each one had a golden ball floating right in front of the body. That seemed familiar. Glory Spren, he thought. It was like the fierce Spren whose antennae manifested in the real world. Only part of the actual Spren showed there.
So, Syl said, not going to sleep?
Kaladin shook his head.
Now, I might not be an expert on humans, she said. For example, I still haven't figured out why only a handful of your cultures seem to worship me. But I do think I heard somewhere that you have to sleep. Like, every night.
He didn't respond.
Kaladin...
What about you? He said, looking away along the isthmus of land that marked where the river was in the real world. Don't you sleep?
Have I ever needed sleep?
Isn't this your land, where you come from? I figured you'd, I don't know, be more mortal here.
I'm still a Spren, she said. I'm a little piece of God. Did you miss the part about worshipping me?
When he didn't reply, she poked him in the side.
You were supposed to say something sarcastic there.
Sorry.
We don't sleep, we don't eat. I think we might feed off humans, actually. Your emotions. Or you thinking about us, maybe. It all seems very complicated. In Shadesmar, we can think on our own, but if we go to your realm, we need a human bond. Otherwise, we're practically as mindless as those Glory Spren.
But how did you make the transition?
I...
She adopted a distant expression.
You called for me. Or, no. I knew that you would someday call for me. So I transferred to the physical realm, trusting that the honor of men lived, unlike what my father always said.
Her father... The Storm Father. It was so strange to be able to feel her head on his arm. He was accustomed to her having very little substance. Could you transfer again? Kaladin asked. To carry word to Dalinar that something might be wrong with the Oath Gates?
I don't think so. You're here and my bond is to you.
She poked him again.
But this is all a distraction from the real problem.
You're right. I need a weapon, and we'll need to find food somehow.
Kaladin,
are there trees on this side? This obsidian might make a good spearhead. She lifted her head from his arm and looked at him with wide, worried eyes. I'm fine, Syl, he said. I just lost my focus.
You were basically catatonic.
I won't let it happen again.
I'm not complaining.
She wrapped her arms around his right arm like a child clinging to a favored toy, worried, frightened.
Something's wrong inside you, but I don't know what.
I've never locked up in real combat, he thought. Not since that day in training when Tux had to come talk to me. I was just surprised to find Saw there, he said. Not to mention Moash. How do you do it? How can you hurt people, Tux? She closed her eyes and leaned against him without letting go of his arm. Eventually, he heard the others stirring, so he extricated himself from Syl's grasp and went to join them. 92. Water, warm as blood. The most important point I wish to make is that the unmade are still among us. I realize this will be contentious, as much of the lore surrounding them is intertwined with theology. However, it is clear to me that some of their effects are common in the world, and we simply treat them as we would the manifestations of other Spren. From Hesse's Mythica, page 12. The Skybreaker test was to take place in a modest-sized town on the north border of the Pure Lake. Some people lived in the lake, of course, but sane society avoided that. Zeth landed, well, was landed, near the center of the town square along with the other hopefuls.
The main bulk of the Skybreakers either remained in the air or settled onto the cliffs around the town. Three masters landed near Zeth, as did a handful of younger men and women who could lash themselves. The group being tested today would include hopefuls like Zeth, who needed to find a master and swear the second ideal, and squires who had achieved that step already but now needed to attract a spren and speak the third ideal. It was a varied group. The Skybreakers didn't seem to care for ethnicity or eye color. Zeth was the only Shin among them, but the others included Makabaki, Reshi, Vorins, Iriali, and even one Thalen. A tall, strong man in a Marabethian wrap and an Azish coat hefted himself from his seat on a porch.
"It took you long enough,"
he said in Azish, striding toward them.
"I sent for you hours ago. The convicts have escaped into the lake. Who knows how far they've gotten by now? They will kill again if not stopped. Find and deal with them. You'll know them by the tattoos of their foreheads."
The masters turned to the squires and hopefuls. Some of the more eager among them immediately went running toward the water. Several that could lash took to the sky. Zeth lingered, along with four of the others. He stepped up to Ki in her shoulder cloak of a high judge of Marabethia.
"How did this man know to send for us?" Zeth asked. "We have been expending our influence, following the advent of the new storm," she replied. "The local monarchs have accepted us as a unifying martial force and have given us legal authority. The city's high minister wrote to us via Spanreed pleading for help."
"And these convicts?" a squire asked. "What do we know of them, and our duty here?"
"This group of convicts escaped the prison there along the cliffs. Their report says they are dangerous murderers. Your task is to find the guilty and execute them. We have writs ordering their deaths."
"All of those who escaped are guilty?"
"They are."
At that, several of the other squires left, hurrying to prove themselves. Still, Zeth lingered. Something about the situation bothered him.
"If these men are murderers, why were they not executed before?" "This area is populated by Reshi idealists, Zeth San Nutoro," Ki said. "They have a strange, non-violent attitude, even toward criminals. This town is charged with holding prisoners from all across the region, and Minister Kwati is paid tribute to maintain these facilities. Now that the murderers have escaped, mercy is withdrawn. They are to be executed."
That was enough for the last two squires who took to the sky to begin their search, and Zeth supposed it was enough for him as well.
"These are Skybreakers," he thought. "They wouldn't knowingly send us after innocence."
He could have taken their implied approval at the start. Yet, something bothered him. This was a test, but of what? Was it merely about the speed with which they could dispatch the guilty? He started toward the waters.
"Zeth, son Naturo," Ki called to him.
"Yes?"
"You walk on stone. Why is this? Each Shin I have known calls stone holy and refuses to set foot on it." "It cannot be holy. If it truly were, Master Ki, it would have burned me away long ago."
He nodded to her, then stepped into the Pure Lake. The water was warmer than he'd remembered. It wasn't deep at all. Reportedly, even in the very center of the lake, the water wouldn't reach higher than a man's thigh, save for the occasional sinkhole.
"You are far behind those others," the sword said. "You're never going to catch anyone at this rate."
"I knew a voice like yours once, Sword Nimi."
"The whispers?"
"No. A single one, in my mind, when I was young."
Zeth shaded his eyes, looking across the glistening lake.
"I hope things go better this time."
The flying squires would catch anyone in the open, so Zeth would need to search for less obvious criminals. He only needed one.
"One?" the sword said. "You're not being ambitious enough."
"Perhaps. Sword Nimi, do you know why you were given to me?"
"Because you needed help. I'm good at helping."
But why me?
Zeth continued trudging through the water.
Nin said I was never to let you leave my presence.
It seemed like more of a burden than an aid. Yes, the sword was a shard blade, but one he'd been cautioned about drawing. The Pure Lake seemed to extend forever, wide as an ocean. Zeth's steps startled schools of fish which would follow behind him for a bit, occasionally nipping at his boots. Gnarled trees poked from the shallows, gorging themselves on the water while their roots grasped the many holes and furrows in the lake bed. Rock outcrops broke the lake near the coast, but inward, the Pure Lake grew placid, more empty. Zeth turned parallel to the shore.
You're not going the same way as the others.
That was true.
Honestly, Zeth, I have to be frank. You aren't good at slaying evil. We haven't killed anyone while you've held me. I wonder, Sword Nimi, did Nin Sun God give you to me so I could practice resisting your encouragements, or because he saw me as equally bloodthirsty? He did call us a good match.
I'm not bloodthirsty,
the sword said immediately.
I just want to be useful.
And not bored?
Well, that too.
The sword made some soft hums, imitating a human deep in thought.
You say you killed many people before we met, but the whispers, you didn't take pleasure in destroying those who needed to be destroyed?
I am not convinced that they needed to be destroyed.
You killed them?
I was sworn to obey.
By a magic rock.
He had explained his past to the sword several times now. For some reason, it had difficulty understanding or remembering certain things.
The Oathstone had no magic. I obeyed because of honor, and I sometimes obeyed evil or petty men. Now I seek a higher ideal.
But what if you picked the wrong thing to follow? Couldn't you end up in the same place again? Can't you just find evil, then destroy it?
And what is evil, Sword Nimi?
I'm sure you can spot it. You seem smart, if increasingly kind of boring.
Would that he could continue in such monotony. Nearby, a large twisted tree rose from the bank. Several of the leaves along one branch were pulled in, seeking refuge inside the bark. Someone had disturbed them. Zeth didn't give overt indication that he'd noticed, but angled his walk so that he stepped beneath the tree. Part of him hoped the man hiding in the tree had the sense to stay hidden. He did not. The man leaped for Zeth, perhaps tempted by the prospect of obtaining a fine weapon. Zeth sidestepped, but without lashings he felt slow, awkward. He escaped the slashes of the convict's improvised dagger, but was forced back toward the water.
Finally,
the sword said.
All right, here's what you have to do. Fight him and win, Zeth.
The criminal rushed him. Zeth caught the hand with the dagger, twisting to use the man's own momentum to send him stumbling into the lake. Recovering, the man turned toward Zeth, who was trying to read what he could from the man's ragged, sorry appearance. Matted, shaggy hair, reshy skin bearing many lesions. The poor fellow was so filthy, beggars and street urchins would find him distasteful company. The convict passed his knife from one hand to the other, wary. Then he rushed Zeth again. Zeth caught the man by the wrist once more and spun him around, the water splashing. Predictably, the man dropped his knife, which Zeth plucked from the water. He dodged the man's grapple and in a moment had one arm around the convict's neck. Zeth raised the knife and, before he formed conscious thought, pressed the blade against the man's chest, drawing blood. He managed to pull back, preventing himself from killing the convict. Fool! He needed to question the man. Had his time as truthless made him such an eager killer? Zeth lowered the knife, but that gave the man an opening to twist and pull them both down into the Pure Lake. Zeth splashed into water warm as blood. The criminal landed on top and forced Zeth under the surface, slamming his hand against the stony bottom and making him drop the knife. The world became a distorted blur.
This isn't winning, the sword said.
How ironic it would be to survive the murder of kings and shardbearers only to die at the hands of a man with a crude knife. Zeth almost let it happen, but he knew fate was not finished with him yet. He threw off the criminal, who was weak and scrawny. The man tried to grab the knife, which was clearly visible beneath the surface, while Zeth rolled the other direction to gain some distance. Unfortunately, the sword on his back got caught between the stones of the lake bottom, and that caused him to jerk back to the water. Zeth growled and, with a heave, ripped himself free, breaking the sword's harness strap. The weapon sank into the water. Zeth splashed to his feet, turning to face the winded, dirty convict. The man glanced at the submerged silver sword. His eyes glazed, then he grinned wickedly, dropped his knife, and dove for the sword. Curious. Zeth stepped back as the convict came up looking gleeful, holding the weapon. Zeth punched him across the face, his arm leaving a faint afterimage. He grabbed the sheathed sword, ripping it from the weaker man's hands. Though the weapon often seemed too heavy for its size, it now felt light in his fingers. He stepped to the side and swung it, sheath and all, at his enemy. The weapon struck the convict's back with a sickening crunch. The poor man splashed down into the lake and fell still.
"I suppose that will do," the sword said. "Really, you should have just used me in the first place."
Zeth shook himself. Had he killed the fellow after all? Zeth knelt and pulled him up by his matted hair. The convict gasped, but his body didn't move. Not dead, but paralyzed.
"Did someone work with you in your escape?" Zeth asked. "One of the local nobility, perhaps?"
"What?"
the man sputtered.
"Oh, Van Macaque, what have you done to me? I can't feel my arms, my legs."
"Did anyone from the outside help you?"
"No. Why would you ask?"
the man sputtered.
"Wait, yes. Who do you want me to name? I'll do whatever you say, please."
Zeth considered. Not working with the guards then, or the minister of the town.
"How did you get out?"
"Oh, no, Rolik,"
the man said, crying.
"We shouldn't have killed the guard. I just wanted to see the sun again."
Zeth dropped the man back into the water. He stepped onto the shore and sat down on a rock, breathing deeply. Not long ago, he had danced with a windrunner at the front of a storm. Today, he fought in shallow water against a half-starved man. Oh, how he missed the sky.
"That was cruel," the sword said, "leaving him to drown."
"Better than feeding him to a great shell," Zeth said. "That happens to criminals in this kingdom."
"Both are cruel," the sword said.
"You know of cruelty, Sword Nimi?"
"Vivenna used to tell me that cruelty is only for men, as is mercy. Only we can choose one or the other, and beasts cannot."
"You count yourself as a man?"
"No. But sometimes she talked like she did. And after Shashara made me, she argued with Vasha, saying I could be a poet or a scholar. Like a man, right?"
"Shashara?" That sounded like Shalash, the eastern name for the herald Shush Daughter God. So perhaps this sword's origin was with the heralds. Zeth rose and walked up the coast, back toward the town.
"Aren't you going to search for other criminals?"
"I needed only one, Sword Nimi, to test what has been told to me and to learn a few important facts."
"Like how smelly convicts are?"
"That is indeed part of the secret."
He passed the small town where the master skybreakers waited, then hiked up the hillside to the prison. The dark block of a structure overlooked the pure lake, but the beautiful vantage was wasted. The place had barely any windows. Inside, the smell was so foul he had to breathe through his mouth. The body of a single guard had been left in a pool of blood between cells. Zeth almost tripped over it. There was no light in the place, save for a few sphere lamps in the guard post.
"I see," he thought, kneeling beside the fallen man.
Yes. This test was indeed a curious one. Outside, he noted some of the squires returning to the town with corpses in tow, though none of the other hopefuls seemed to have found anyone. Zeth picked his way carefully down the rocky slope to the town, careful not to drag the sword. Whatever Nin's reasons for entrusting him with the weapon, it was a holy object. At the town, he approached the beefy nobleman who was trying to make small talk with Master Key, failing spectacularly. Nearby, other members of the town were debating the ethics of simply executing murderers, or holding them and risking this. Zeth inspected the dead convicts, and found them as dirty as the one he had fought, though two weren't nearly as emaciated. There was a prison economy, Zeth thought. Food went to those in power, while others were starved.
You, Zeth said to the nobleman. I found only one body above. Did you really have a single guard posted to watch all these prisoners?
The nobleman sneered at him.
A Shin Stonewalker? Who are you to question me? Go back to your stupid grass and dead trees, little man.
The prisoners were free to create their own hierarchy, Zeth continued, and nobody watched to see they didn't make weapons, as I faced one with a knife. These men were mistreated, locked in darkness, not given enough food.
They were criminals, murderers.
And what happened to the money you were sent to administrate this facility? It certainly didn't go toward proper security.
I don't have to listen to this.
Zeth turned from him to Key.
Do you have a writ of execution for this man? It is the first we obtained.
What?
The nobleman said. Fear Spren boiled up around him. Zeth undid the clasp on the sword and drew it. A rushing sound, like a thousand screams. A wave of power like the beating of a terrible, stunning wind. Colors changed around him. They deepened, growing darker and more vibrant. The city nobleman's cloak became a stunning array of deep oranges and blood reds. The hair on Zeth's arms stood on end, and his skin spiked with a sudden, incredible pain.
Destroy!
Liquid darkness flowed from the blade, then melted to smoke as it fell. Zeth screamed at the pain in his arm even as he slammed the weapon through the chest of the blubbering nobleman. Flesh and blood puffed instantly into black smoke. Ordinary shard blades burned only the eyes, but this sword somehow consumed the entire body. It seemed to sear away even the man's soul.
Evil.
Veins of black liquid crept up Zeth's hand and arm. He gaped at them, then gasped and rammed the sword back into its silvery sheath. He fell to his knees, dropping the sword and raising his hand, fingers bent and tendons taut. Slowly the blackness evaporated from his flesh, the awful pain easing. The skin of his hand, which had already been pale, had been bleached to gray-white. The sword's voice sank to a deep muttering in his mind, its words slurring. It struck him as sounding like the voice of a beast falling into a stupor, after having gorged itself. Zeth breathed deeply. Fumbling at his pouch, he saw that several spheres inside were completely drained.
I will need far more stormlight if I'm ever to try that again.
The surrounding townspeople, squires, and even Master Skybreakers regarded him with uniform horror. Zeth picked up the sword and struggled to his feet before fastening the sword's clasp. Holding the sheathed weapon in both hands, he bowed to Key.
I have dealt, he said, with the worst of the criminals. You have done well, she said slowly, glancing at where the nobleman had stood.
There wasn't even a stain on the stones.
We will wait and make certain the other criminals have been killed or captured.
Wise, Zeth said.
Could I beg something to drink? I suddenly find myself very thirsty.
By the time all the escapees had been accounted for, the sword was stirring again. It had never fallen asleep, if a sword could do such a thing. Rather, it had mumbled in his mind until it slowly became lucid.
Hey, the sword said, as Zeth sat on a low wall alongside the city. Hey, did you draw me?
I did, Sword Nimi.
Great job! Did we destroy lots of evil?
A great and corrupt evil.
Wow! I'm impressed. You know, Vivenna never drew me even once. She carried me for a long time, too. Maybe a couple of days, even.
And how long have I been carrying you?
At least an hour, the sword said, satisfied. 1 or 2 or 10,000, something like that.
Key approached, and he returned her water canteen.
Thank you, Master Key. I have decided to take you as my squire, Zeth son Naturo, she said. In all honesty, there was an argument among us over who would have the privilege.
He bowed his head.
I may swear the second ideal.
You may.
Justice will serve you until you attract a spren and swear to a more specific code. During my prayers last night, Winnow proclaimed the high spren are watching you. I won't be surprised if it takes mere months before you achieve the third ideal.
Months? No. He would not take months. But he did not swear quite yet. Instead, he nodded toward the prison.
Pardon, Master. A question. You knew this breakout would happen, didn't you?
We suspected. One of our teams investigated this man and discovered how he was using his funds. When the call came, we were not surprised. It provided a perfect testing opportunity.
Why not deal with him earlier?
You must understand our purpose and our place. A fine point difficult for many squires to grasp. That man had not yet broken a law. His duty was to imprison the convicts, which he had done. He was allowed to judge if his methods were satisfactory or not. Only once he failed, and his charges had escaped, could we mete out justice.
Zeth nodded.
I swear to seek justice, to let it guide me. Until I find a more perfect ideal.
These words are accepted, Key said.
She removed a glowing emerald sphere from her pouch.
Take your place above, Squire.
Zeth regarded the sphere, then, trembling, breathed in the stormlight. It returned to him in a rush. The skies were his once again. 93. Kata. Taxil mentioned Yelignar, named Blightwind, in an oft-cited quote. Though Yasna Kolin has famously called its accuracy into question, I believe it. From Hesse's Mythica, page 26. When Adolin woke up, he was still in the nightmare. The dark sky, glass ground, the strange creatures. He had a crick in his neck and a pain in his back. He'd never mastered the sleep-anywhere skill the grunts bragged about. Father could have slept on the ground, a part of him thought. Dalinar is a true soldier. Adolin thought again of the jolt he'd felt when ramming his dagger through Satius's eye and into his brain. Satisfaction and shame. Strip away Adolin's nobility and what was left. A duelist, when a world needed generals? A hothead who couldn't even take an insult? A murderer? He threw off his coat and sat up, then jumped and gasped as he found the woman with the scratched-out eyes looming over him.
Ishar's soul! Adolin cursed. Do you have to stay so close?
She didn't move. Adolin sighed, then changed the dressing on his shallow shoulder cut, using bandages from his pocket. Nearby, Shallan and Azure catalogued their meager supplies. Kaladin trudged over to join them. Had the bridge boy slept? Adolin stretched, then, accompanied by his ghostly spren, walked down the short slope to the ocean of glass beads. A few life spren floated nearby. On this side, their glowing green motes had tufts of white hair that rippled as they danced and bobbed. Perhaps they were circling plants by the riverbank in the physical realm? Those small dots of light swimming above the rock might be the souls of fish. How did that work? In the real world, they'd be in the water, so shouldn't they be inside the stone? He knew so little and felt so overwhelmed, so insignificant. A fierce spren crawled up out of the ocean of beads, purple antenna pointing at him. It scuttled closer until Adolin picked up some beads and threw one at the spren, which scuttled back into the ocean and lurked there, watching him. "What do you think of all this?" Adolin asked the woman with the scratched-out eyes. She didn't respond, but he often talked to his sword without it responding. He tossed up one of the beads and caught it. Shallan could tell what each represented, but all he got was a dull impression of something red. "I'm being childish, aren't I?" Adolin asked. "So, forces moving in the world now make me look insignificant. That's no different from a child growing up and realizing his little life isn't the center of the universe, right?" Problem was, his little life had been the center of the universe growing up. "Welcome to being the son of Dalinar Storming Blackthorn." He hurled the spear into the sea where it skittered against its fellows. Adolin sighed, then started a morning kata. Without a sword, he fell back on the first kata he'd ever learned, an extended sequence of stretches, hand-to-hand moves, and stances to help loosen his muscles. The forms calmed him. The world was turning on its head, but familiar things were still familiar. Strange that he should have come to that revelation. About halfway through, he noticed Azure standing on the bank. She walked down the slope and fell into line beside him, doing the same kata. She must have known it already, for she kept pace with him exactly. They stepped back and forth along the rocks, sparring with their own shadows, until Kaladin approached and joined them. He wasn't as practiced and cursed under his breath as he got a sequence wrong, but he'd obviously done it before, too. "He must have learned it from Zahel," Adolin realized. The three moved together, their breathing controlled, scraping boots on the glass. The sea of beads rolling against itself began to sound soothing, even rhythmic. "The world is the same as it's always been," Adolin thought. "Those things we're finding, monsters and radiance, aren't new. They were only hidden. The world has always been like this, even if I didn't know it." And Adolin, he was still himself. He had all the same things to be proud of, didn't he? Same strengths, same accomplishments, same flaws, too. "Are you three dancing?" a voice suddenly piped up. Adolin immediately spun around. Shallan had settled on the slope above them, still wearing her white uniform, hat, and single glove. He found himself grinning stupidly. "It's a warm-up, kata," he explained. "You—"
"I know what it is. You tried to teach it to me, remember? I just thought it odd to see you all down here like that."
She shook her head.
"Weren't we going to plan how to get out of here?"
Together, they started up the slope, and Azure fell into step beside Adolin.
"Where did you learn that kata?"
"From my sword master." "You?"
"Likewise." As they approached their camp in the small nest-like depression in the obsidian ground, something felt off to Adolin. Where was his sword? The woman with the scratched-out eyes? He stepped back and spotted her standing on the coast, looking at her feet.
"All right," Shallan said, drawing him back. "I made a list of our supplies."
She gestured with a pencil toward the items, which were arrayed on the ground as she spoke.
"One bag of gemstones from the Emerald Reserve. I used roughly half of our stormlight in our transfer to Shadesmar and crossing the Sea of Beads. We have my satchel with charcoal, reed pens, brushes, ink, lacquer, some solvents, three sketch pads, my sharpening knife, and one jar of jam I had stowed inside for an emergency snack.
Wonderful, Kaladin said. I'm sure a pile of brushes will be useful in fighting off void spren.
Better than your tongue, which is notably dull lately. Adolin has his side knife, but our only real weapon is Azure's shard blade. Kaladin brought the bag of gemstones inside his pack, which fortunately also contained his travel rations. 3 meals of flatbread and jerked pork. We also have a water jug and 3 canteens.
Mine is half empty, Adolin noted.
Mine too,
Azure said.
Which means we have maybe 1 day's worth of water and 3 meals for 4 people. Last time I crossed Shades Mar, it took 4 weeks.
Obviously, Kaladin said, we have to get back through the Oath Gate into the city.
Pattern hummed, standing behind Shallan. He seemed like a statue. He didn't shift his weight or move in small ways like a human would. Kaladin's spren was different. She always seemed to be moving, slipping this way or that, girlish dress rippling as she walked, her hair swaying.
Bad, Pattern said. The spren of the Oathgate are bad now.
Do we have any other options? Kaladin said.
I remember some, Syl said. Much more than I used to. Our land, every land, is 3 realms. The highest is the spiritual, where gods live. There, all things, times, and spaces are made into one. We're now in the cognitive realm, Shadesmar, where spren live. You are from the physical realm. The only way I know of to transfer there is to be pulled by human emotions. That won't help you, as you're not spren.
There's another way to transfer between realms, Azure said. I've used it. Her hair had recovered its dark coloring, and it seemed to Adolin that her scars had faded. Something about her was downright strange. She seemed almost like a spren herself. She bore his scrutiny, looking from him to Kaladin to Shallan. Finally, she sighed deeply.
Story time?
Yes, please, Adolin replied. You've traveled in this place before?
I'm from a far land, and I came to Roshar by crossing this place, Shadesmar.
All right, Adolin said, but why?
I came chasing someone.
A friend?
A criminal, she said softly.
You're a soldier, though, Kaladin said.
Not really. In Kolinar, I merely stepped up to do a job nobody else was doing. I thought perhaps the wall guard would have information on the man I'm hunting. Everything went wrong, and I got stuck.
When you arrived in our land, Shallan said, you used an oath gate to get from Shadesmar to the physical realm?
No,
Azure laughed, shaking her head. I didn't know of those until Cal told me about them. I used a portal between realms. Cultivation's perpendicularity, they call it. On your side, it's in the Horneater Peaks.
That's hundreds of miles from here, Adolin said.
There's supposedly another perpendicularity, Azure said. It's unpredictable and dangerous and appears randomly in different places. My guides warned against trying to hunt it.
Guides? Kaladin said. Who were these guides?
Why, spren, of course. Adolin glanced toward the distant city they'd left, where there had been fear spren and pain spren aplenty.
Not like those, Azure said, laughing. People spren. Like these two.
Which raises a question, Adolin said, pointing as the spren with the strange eyes rejoined them. That's the soul of my shard blade. Syl is Kaladin's and Pattern Shallan's. So, he pointed at the weapon at her belt. Tell us honestly, Azure. Are you a Knight Radiant?
No.
Adolin swallowed.
Say it.
You're a herald, then. She laughed.
No.
What? A herald? Those are basically gods, right? I'm no figure from mythology, thank you very much. I'm just a woman who has been constantly out of her league since adolescence. Trust me.
Adolin glanced at Kaladin. He didn't seem convinced either.
Really?
Azure said. There's no spren here for my blade because it's flawed. I can't summon or dismiss it like you can yours. She's a handy weapon, but a pale copy of what you carry. She patted it. Anyway, when I last crossed this place, I hired a ship to convey me.
A ship? Kaladin said.
Sailed by whom?
Spren. I hired it at one of their cities.
Cities? Kaladin looked toward Syl. You have cities?
Where do you think we lived?
Syl said, amused.
Lightspren are usually guides, Azure continued. They like to travel, to see new places. They sail all across Roshar's Shadesmar, peddling goods, trading with other spren. You're supposed to watch out for cryptics.
Pattern hummed happily.
Yes, we are very famous.
What about using soul casting? Adolin looked to Shallan. Could you make us supplies?
I don't think it would work, Shallan replied. When I soul cast, I change an object's soul here in this realm, and it reflects in the other world. If I changed one of these beads, it might become something new in the physical realm, but it would still be a bead to us.
Food and water aren't impossible to find here, Azure said, if you can make it to a port city. The spren don't need these things, but humans living on this side, and there are some, need a constant supply. With that stormlight of yours, we can trade. Maybe buy passage to the Horneater Peaks.
That would take a long time, Kaladin said. Alethkar is falling right now, and the Blackthorn needs us.
He was interrupted by a haunting screech. It was reminiscent of sheets of steel grinding against one another. It was met by others, echoing in unison. Adolin spun toward the sounds, shocked by their intensity. Syl put her hands to her lips, and Pattern cocked his strange head.
What was that? Kaladin demanded.
Azure hurriedly began shoving their supplies into Kaladin's pack.
You remember before we slept how I said we'd be fine unless we attracted the wrong spren?
Yes.
We should get moving.
Now.
Illustration. Rosharan Wines. The cultured Vorin knows their wines and speaks confidently on the subject. Types of wine, in order of strength. Weakest, pink. Floral aids alertness.
I've had milk more intoxicating than this.
Orange, fruity, with notes of ginger. Yellow, bold and deep, without guilt. Auburn, spicy taste with an earthy aroma.
Made from fermented fruit, and is similar to the grapevines we're used to.
Red, flavorful with a pleasant burn. Sapphire, nutty taste with hints of honey.
Made from fermented lapis grain. Depending on the infusions, this traditionally tastes more like whiskey.
Strongest, blue, complex notes of berry and lemon. Violet, spiced sandalwood aroma. It serves the cultured Vorin well to be versed in the diverse beers, mud beers, ciders, juices, and lagers of other cultures. Cider is served chilled, if possible. Horn-eater lager should not be drunk in the presence of enemies.
Responsible for that embarrassing tattoo of mine.
Winespren are quite rare, reported only in foreign nations.
What? Rare? I see these all the time.
94. A small bottle. 7 years ago. Dalinar stumbled as he swept everything from the dresser, upending a bowl of hot soup. He didn't want soup. He yanked out drawers, dumping clothing to the ground, steam curling from the spilled broth. They'd done it again.
They'd taken his bottles. How dare they? Couldn't they hear the weeping? He roared, then grabbed his trunk, overturning it. A flask rolled out along with the clothing. Finally, something they hadn't found. He slurped down the dregs it contained and groaned. The weeping echoed around him. Children dying. Evie begging for her life. He needed more. But wait. Did he need to be presentable? The hunt. Was that today? Stupid man, he thought. The last of the hunts had been weeks ago. He'd convinced Gavilar to come with him out into the wilderness, and the trip had gone well. Dalinar had been presentable, sober, commanding even. A figure right from the Storming Songs. They'd discovered those parshmen. They'd been so interesting. For a time, away from civilization, Dalinar had felt like himself. His old self. He hated that person. Growling, he dug in his large wardrobe. This fort on the eastern rim of Alethkar was the first mark of civilization on their trip home. It had given Dalinar access again to the necessities of life, like wine. He barely heard the rap on his door as he flung coats out of the wardrobe. When he looked over, he saw two youths standing there, his sons. Anger Spren boiled around him. Her hair, her judgmental eyes. How many lies about him had she stuffed into their heads? What? Dalinar roared. Adolin stood his ground. Almost 17 now, fully a man. The other one, the invalid, cringed down. He looked younger than his, what, 12 years, 13? We heard the commotion, sir, Adolin said, jutting out his chin. We thought you might need help. I need nothing. Out! Get out! They scrambled away. Dalinar's heart raced. He slammed the wardrobe and pounded his fists on the bedside table, toppling the sphere lamp. Puffing, groaning, he fell to his knees. Storms. They were only a few days' march from the ruins of Rathalas. Was that why the screaming was louder today? A hand fell on his shoulder. Father? Adolin, so help me. Still kneeling, Dalinar turned, then cut off. It wasn't Adolin, but the other one. Renarin had returned, timid as always, his spectacled eyes wide and his hand trembling. He held something out, a small bottle.
I,
Renarin swallowed.
Got you one, with the spheres the king gave me. Because you always go through what you buy so quickly.
Dalinar stared at that bottle of wine for an endless moment. Gavilar hides the wine from me, he mumbled. That's why none is left. I couldn't possibly have drunk it all. Renarin stepped in and hugged him. Dalinar flinched, bracing as if for a punch. The boy clung to him, not letting go.
They talk about you,
Renarin said.
But they're wrong. You just need to rest after all the fighting you did. I know. And I miss her too.
Dalinar licked his lips.
What did she tell you? He said, voice ragged. What did your mother say about me?
The only honest officer in the army,
Renarin said.
The honorable soldier. Noble, like the heralds themselves. Our father, the greatest man in Alethkar.
What stupid words. Yet Dalinar found himself weeping. Renarin let go, but Dalinar grabbed him, pulling him close.
Oh, almighty. Oh, God. Oh, God, please. I've started to hate my sons.
Why hadn't the boys learned to hate him back? They should hate him. He deserved to be hated.
Please. Anything.
I don't know how to get free of this. Help me. Help me.
Dalinar wept. and clung to that youth, that child, as if he were the only real thing left in a world of shadows. 95. Inescapable Void. Yelignar had great powers, perhaps the powers of all searchers compounded in one. He could transform any Voidbringer into an extremely dangerous enemy. Curiously, three legends I found mention swallowing a gemstone to engage this process. From Hesse's Mythica, page 27. Kaladin marched at speed through Shadesmar, trying, with difficulty, to control the simmering dissatisfaction inside of him. Pattern said as another screech sounded behind them. Humans, you must stop your emotions. They are very inconvenient here. The group hiked southward along the narrow line of land that overlaid the river in the real world. Shallan was the slowest of them and had difficulty keeping up. So they'd agreed she should hold a little stormlight. It was either that or let the screeching spren reach them. What are they like? Adolin said to Azure, puffing as they marched. You said those sounds were from anger spren. Boiling pools of blood? That's the part you see in the physical realm, Azure said. Here, that's merely their saliva, pooling as they drool. They're nasty.
And dangerous, Syl said.
She scampered along the obsidian ground and didn't seem to get tired.
Even to spren. But how did we draw them? Nobody was angry, right?
Kaladin tried again to smother his frustration.
I wasn't feeling anything other than tired, Shallan said.
I felt overwhelmed, Adolin said. Still do, but not angry.
Kaladin?
Syl said. He looked at the others, then down at his feet. It just feels like we're abandoning Kolinar. And only I care. You were talking about how to get food, find a way to the Horneater Peaks, this perpendicularity or whatever. But we're abandoning people to the Voidbringers.
I care too, Adolin said. Bridgeboy, that was my home.
I know, Kaladin snapped. He took a breath, forcing himself to calm.
I know, Adolin. I know it's not rational to try to get back through the Oath Gate. We don't know how to work it from this side, and besides, it's obviously been corrupted. My emotions are irrational. I'll try to contain them. I promise.
They fell silent. You're not angry at Adolin, Kaladin thought forcefully. You're not actually angry at anyone. You're just looking for something to latch on to. Something to feel. Because the darkness was coming. It fed off the pain of defeat, the agony of losing men he'd tried to protect. But it could feed off anything. Life going well, the darkness would whisper that he was only setting himself up for a bigger fall. Shallan glances at Adolin, they must be whispering about him. Dalinar sends him to protect Elokar, the High Prince must want to get rid of Kaladin. He'd failed at that regardless. When Dalinar heard that Kolinar had fallen.
Get out, Kaladin thought, squeezing his eyes shut.
Get out, get out, get out! It would continue until numbness seemed preferable. Then that numbness would claim him and make it hard to do anything at all. It would become a sinking, inescapable void from within which everything looked washed out. Dead. Within that dark place, he'd wanted to betray his oaths. Within that dark place, he'd given the king up to assassins and murderers. Eventually, the screeches faded into the distance. Syl guessed that the anger spren had been drawn into the beads, off toward Kolinar and the powerful emotions there. The group continued their hike. There was only one way to go, south, along the narrow peninsula of obsidian running through the bead ocean.
When I traveled here last time, Azure said, we passed numbers of peninsulas like this one. They always had lighthouses at the ends. We stopped at them sometimes for supplies.
Yes, Syl said, nodding. I remember those. It's useful for ships to note where land juts into the beads.
There should be one at the end of this one, though it looks long. You'll have to hike it for several days.
At least it's a goal, Adolin said. We travel south, get to the lighthouse, and hope to catch a ship there.
There was an insufferable spring to his step, like he was actually excited by this terrible place. Idiot Adolin, who probably didn't even understand the consequences of... Stop it! Stop it! He helped you. Storms. Kaladin hated himself when he got like this. When he tried to empty his mind, he drifted toward the void of darkness. But when he instead let himself think, he started remembering what had happened in Kolinar. Men he loved, killing each other. Awful, terrifying perspective. He could see too many sides. Parshman angry at being enslaved for years, attempting to overthrow a corrupt government. Alethe protecting their homes from invading monsters. Elikar trying to save his son. The palace guards trying to keep their oaths. Too many eyes to see through. Too many emotions. Were these his only two options? Pain or oblivion? Fight it. Their hike continued, and he tried to turn his attention to his surroundings instead of his thoughts. The thin peninsula wasn't barren, as he'd first assumed. Growing along its edges were small, brittle plants that looked like ferns. When he asked, Syl told him they grew exactly like plants in the physical realm. Most were black, but occasionally they had vibrant colors, blended together like stained glass. None grew higher than his knees, and most only reached his ankles. He felt terrible whenever he brushed one, and it crumpled. The sun didn't seem to change position in the sky, no matter how long they walked. Through spaces between the clouds, he saw only blackness. No stars, no moons. Eternal, endless darkness. They camped for what should have been the night, then hiked all the next day. Kolinar vanished into the distance behind, but they still kept going. Azure at the front, then Pattern, Syl, and Kaladin, with Shallan and Adolin at the back. Adolin's Spren trailing them. Kaladin would have preferred to take the rear guard, but if he tried, Adolin positioned himself to the back again. What did the princeling think? That Kaladin would lag behind, if not minded? Syl walked beside him, mostly quiet. Being back on this side troubled her. She'd look at things, like the occasional colorful plant, and cock her head as if trying to remember.
It's like a dream from the time when I was dead, she'd said when he prompted her.
They camped another night, then started walking again. Kaladin skipped breakfast. Their rations were basically gone. Besides, he welcomed the grumbling stomach. It reminded him that he was alive, gave him something to think about, other than the men he'd lost.
Where did you live?
He asked Syl, still carrying his pack, hiking along the seemingly infinite peninsula.
When you were young, on this side. It was far to the west, she said. A grand city, ruled by honor, Spren. I didn't like it, though. I wanted to travel, but father kept me in the city, especially after, you know.
I'm not actually sure that I do.
I bonded a knight radiant. Haven't I told you of him? I remember...
She closed her eyes as she walked, chin up, as if basking in a wind he could not feel.
I bonded him soon after I was born. He was an elderly man, kindly, but he did fight. In one battle. And he died.
She blinked open her eyes.
That was a long time ago.
I'm sorry.
It's all right. I wasn't ready, though, for the bond. Spren normally weather the death of their radiant, but I lost myself when I lost him. It all turned out to be morbidly fortuitous because soon after, the recreants happened. Men forsook their oaths, which killed my siblings. I survived, for I didn't have a bond then.
And the Stormfather locked you away?
Father assumed I'd been killed with the others. He found me asleep after what must have been... Wow! 1,000 years on your side. He woke me and took me home.
She shrugged.
After that, he wouldn't let me leave the city.
She took Kaladin by the arm.
He was foolish, as were the other honors Bren born after the recreants. They knew something bad was coming, but wouldn't do anything. And I heard you calling, even from so far away.
The Stormfather let you out? Kaladin said, stunned by the confessions. This was more than he'd found out about her since forever.
I snuck away, she said with a grin. I gave up my mind and joined your world, hiding among the winds, Bren. We can barely see them on this side. Did you know that? Some Spren live mostly in your realm. I suppose the wind is always there somewhere, so they don't fade like passions do.
She shook her head.
Oh!
Oh? Kaladin asked. Did you remember something?
No! Oh!
She pointed, hopping up and down.
Look!
In the distance, a bright yellow light glowed like a spark in the otherwise dim landscape. A lighthouse.
96. Pieces of a Fabriel. Yelignar is said to consume souls, but I can't find a specific explanation. I'm uncertain this lore is correct. From Hesse's Mythica, page 51. On the day of the first meeting of monarchs at Urethiru, Navani made each person, no matter how important, carry their own chair. The old Alethi tradition symbolized each chief bringing important wisdom to a gathering. Navani and Dalinar arrived first, stepping off the lift and walking toward the meeting room near the top of Urethiru. Her chair was sensible but comfortable, made of soul-cast wood with a padded seat. Dalinar had tried to bring a stool, but she'd insisted that he do better. This wasn't a battlefield strategy tent, and forced austerity wouldn't impress the monarchs. He'd eventually selected a sturdy wooden chair of thick stump weight, with wide armrests, but no padding. He'd quietly spent the trip up watching floors pass. When Dalinar was troubled, he went silent. His brow would scrunch up in thought, and to everyone else, it looked like he was scowling. "They got out, Dalinar," Navani said to him. "I'm sure they did. Elokar and Adolin are safe, somewhere." He nodded. But even if they had survived, Kolinar had fallen. Was that why he seemed so haunted? No, it was something else. Ever since he'd collapsed after visiting Aesir, it seemed that something in Dalinar had snapped. This morning he had quietly asked her to lead the meeting. She worried deeply for what was happening to him, and for Elokar, and for Kolinar. But storms, they had worked so hard to forge this coalition, she would not let it collapse now. She'd already grieved for a daughter, but then that daughter had returned to her. She had to hope the same for Elokar, at the very least, so she could keep functioning while Dalinar mourned. They settled their chairs in the large meeting room, which had a clear view out flat glass windows overlooking mountains. Servants had already set out refreshment along the curved sidewall of the half-circle room. The tiled floor was inlaid with the image of the double eye of the Almighty, complete with surges and essences. Bridge 4 piled into the room after them. Many had brought simple seats, but the Herdazian had stumbled onto the lift with a chair so grand, inlaid with embroidered blue cloth and silver, it was almost a throne. They settled their chairs behind hers with a fair bit of squabbling, and then attacked the food without waiting for permission. For a group that was essentially one step from being light-eyed shard-bearers, they were an unruly and raucous bunch. Bridge 4 had, characteristically, taken the news of their leader's potential fall with laughter. "Kaladin is tougher than a wind-tossed boulder, Brightness," Teft had told her. "He survived Bridge 4, he survived the chasms, and he'll survive this." She had to admit their optimism was heartening. But if the team had survived, why hadn't they returned during the latest high storm? "Steady," Navani thought to herself, regarding the bridgeman,
who were surrounded by laughter spren. One of those men currently carried Jezereza's honor blade. She couldn't tell which. The blade could be dismissed like an ordinary shard blade, and they swapped it among themselves in order to be unpredictable. Soon the others began arriving on different lifts, and Navani watched carefully. The chair-carrying tradition was, in part, a symbol of equality, but Navani figured she might be able to learn something about the monarchs from their choices. Being a human was about making sense of chaos, finding meaning among the random elements of the world. First to arrive was the young Azish Prime. His tailor had done a wonderful job making his regal costume fit. It would have been easy for the youth to look like a child swimming in those stately robes and that headdress. He carried a very ornate throne covered in loud Azish patterns, and each of his closest advisors helped by holding it with one hand. The large contingent settled in, and others flooded in behind, including three representatives of kingdoms subject to Azir: the Prime of Emul, the Princess of Yazir, and the ambassador from Tashik. All brought chairs that were faintly inferior to that of the Azish Prime. A balancing act went on here. Each of the three monarchies gave just enough respect to the Prime so as not to embarrass him. They were his subjects in name only. Still, Navani should be able to focus her diplomacy efforts on the Prime. Tashik, Emul, and Yazir would fall in line. Two were historically closest with the Azish throne, and the third, Emul, was in no position to stand on its own after the war with Tukar and the Voidbringer assault had basically broken the princedom into pieces. The Alethi contingent arrived next. Renarin, who seemed terrified that something had happened to his brother, brought a simple chair. Yasna had outdone him by actually bringing a padded stool. She and Dalinar could be painfully similar. Navani noticed with annoyance that Sabariel and Polona weren't with the other High Princes. Well, at least they hadn't shown up bearing massage tables. Notably, Iale Sadius ignored the requirement that she carry her own chair. A scarred guardsman placed a sleek, lacquered chair down for her, stained so dark a maroon it might as well have been black. She met Navani's eyes as she sat, cold and confident. Amaram was technically High Prince, but he was still in Thelena, working alongside his soldiers to rebuild the city. Navani doubted Iale would have let him represent them at this meeting anyway. It seemed so long ago when Iale and Navani had huddled together at dinners, conspiring on how to stabilize the kingdom their husbands were conquering. Now Navani wanted to seize the woman and shake her. "Can't you stop being petty for one storming minute?" Well, as had been happening for so long now, the other High Princes would defer either to Colin or to Sadius. Letting Iale participate was a calculated risk. Forbid her, and the woman would find a way to sabotage the proceedings. Let her in, and hopefully she'd start to see the importance of this work. At least Queen Fen and her consort seemed committed to the coalition. They set their chairs by the glass window, backs to the storms, as the Thalans often joked. Their wooden chairs were high-backed, painted blue, and upholstered a pale nautical white. Tara Vangian, bearing a nondescript chair of wood with no padding, asked to join them. The old man had insisted on carrying his own chair, though Navani had specifically excused him, Ashno of Sages, and others with a frail bearing. Adratagia sat with him, as did his surge binder. She didn't go join Bridge 4, and, curiously, Navani realized she still thought of the woman as his surge binder. The only other person of note was Aunak, the Natan ambassador. He represented a dead kingdom that had been reduced to a single city-state on the eastern coast of Roshar, with a few other cities as protectorates. For a moment it all seemed too much
for Navani. The Azish Empire with all its intricacies. The counter-movement among the Alethi High Princes. Taravangian, who was somehow king of Yakaved, the second-largest kingdom on Roshar. Queen Fen and her obligation to the guilds in her city. The Radiance, like the little Reshi who was currently out-eating the huge Horn-Eater Bridgeman, almost as if it were a contest. So much to think about. Now was when Dalinar stepped back? Calm, Navani thought at herself, taking a deep breath. Order from Chaos. Find the structure here and start building upon it. Everyone had naturally arranged themselves into a circle, with monarchs at the front, and high princes, viziers, interpreters, and scribes radiating out from them. Navani stood up and strode into the center. Just as everyone was quieting, Sabariel and his mistress finally sauntered in. They made right for the food, and had apparently forgotten chairs entirely. "I," she said as the room hushed again, "know of no other conference like this in the history of Roshar. Perhaps they were common in the days of the Knights Radiant, but certainly nothing like it has occurred since the Recreants. I would like to both welcome and thank you, our noble guests. Today, we make history." "It only took a desolation to cause it," Sabariel said from the food table. "The world should end more often. It makes everyone so much more accommodating." The various interpreters whispered translations to their charges. Navani found herself wondering if it was too late to have him tossed off the tower. You could do it. The sheer side of Urethiru facing the origin was straight, all the way down. She would watch Sabariel fall practically to the bottom of the mountains if she wanted. "We," Navani said sharply, "are here to discuss the future of Roshar. We must have a unified vision and goal." She glanced around the room as people considered. "He's going to talk first," she thought, noticing the prime of Emul shifting in his seat. His name was Vexil the Wise, but people often referred to the Makabaki princes and primes by their country, much as Alethi High princes were often referred to by their house name.
"The course is obvious, isn't it?" Emul said through an interpreter, though Navani understood his Azish.
He bowed in his seat to the Azish child emperor, then continued,
"We must reclaim my nation from the hands of the traitor Parshman. Then we must conquer Tukar. It is completely unreasonable to allow this insane man who claims to be a god to continue bereaving the glorious Azish Empire."
"This is going to get difficult," Navani thought, as a half dozen other people started to speak at once. She raised her free hand.
"I will do my best to moderate fairly, Your Majesties, but do realize that I am only one person. I depend upon you all to facilitate the discussion rather than trying to talk over one another."
She nodded at the Azish Prime, hoping he'd take the floor. A translator whispered her words into the Prime's left ear. Then Nura the Vizier leaned forward and spoke quietly into the other, undoubtedly giving instructions.
"They'll want to see how this plays out," Navani decided. "One of the others will speak next. They'll want to contrast the Emuli position to assert themselves."
"The throne recognizes the prime of Emul," the little emperor finally said.
"And, we are aware of his desires."
He paused and looked around.
Anyone else have a comment?"
"My brother the prince wishes to address you," said the tall, refined representative from Tashik, who wore a flowery suit of yellow and gold, rather than his people's traditional wrap.
A scribe whispered to him as a span reed scratched out the message Tashik's prince wanted conveyed to the gathering.
"He'll contradict Emul," Navani thought. "Point us in another direction. Toward Eri, maybe?"
"We of Tashik," the ambassador said, "are more interested in the discovery of these glorious portals.
The Alethi have invited us here and told us we're part of a grand coalition. We would respectfully inquire how often we will have use of these gates and how to negotiate tariffs. Immediately, the room exploded with conversation. Our gate, Aunak said, in our historical homeland is being used without our permission. And while we thank the Alethi for securing it for us, if there is to be war, Fenn said, then is a bad time to be discussing tariffs. We should just agree to free trade. Which would help your merchants, Fenn? Sabariel called. How about asking them to help the rest of us out with some free wartime supplies? Imul, the Imuli Prime began. Wait, the Yazir Princess said. Shouldn't we be concerned about Iri and Rira, who seem to have completely fallen in with the enemy? Please, Navani said, interrupting the mess of conversations. Please, let's do this in an orderly way. Perhaps before deciding where to fight, we could discuss how to best equip ourselves against the enemy threat. She looked to Taravangian. Your Majesty, can you tell us more about the shields your scholars in Yakaved are creating?
Yes, they are strong.
How strong? Navani prompted.
Very strong. Yes, strong enough.
He scratched his head and looked at her helplessly.
How strong do you need them to be?
She drew in a deep breath. He wasn't having a good day. Her mother had been like that, lucid on some days, barely cognizant on others. The half shards, Navani said, addressing the room, will give us an edge against the enemy. We have given the plans to the Azish scholars. I'm looking forward to pooling our resources and studying the process.
Could it lead to shard plate? Queen Fenn asked.
Possibly, Navani said. But the more I study what we've discovered here in Urethiru, the more I've come to realize that our image of the ancients having fantastic technology was deeply flawed. An exaggeration at best. Perhaps a fancy.
But shards, Fenn said.
Manifestations of Spren, Yasna explained. Not fabrial technology. Even the gemstones we discovered, containing words of ancient radiance during the days when they left Urethiru, were crude, if used in a way we hadn't yet explored. All this time we've been assuming that we lost great technology in the desolations, but it seems we are far, far more advanced than the ancients ever were. It is the process of bonding Spren that we lost.
Not lost, the Azish Prime said. Abandoned.
He looked toward Dalinar, who sat in a relaxed posture. Not slumped, but not stiff, either. A posture that somehow read as, I'm in control here, don't pretend otherwise. Dalinar loomed over a room even when trying to be unobtrusive. That furrowed brow darkened his blue eyes, and the way he rubbed his chin evoked the image of a man contemplating whom to execute first. The attendees had arranged their seats roughly in a circle, but most of them faced Dalinar, who sat by Navani's chair. After everything that had happened, they didn't trust him.
The ancient oaths are spoken once more, Dalinar said. We are again radiant. This time we will not abandon you. I vow it.
Nura the Vizier whispered in the Azish Prime's ear, and he nodded before speaking.
We are still very concerned about the powers in which you dabble. These abilities. Who is to say that the Lost Radiants were wrong in abandoning them? They were frightened of something, and they locked these portals for a reason.
It is too late to turn back from this now, Your Majesty, Dalinar said. I have bonded the Stormfather himself. We must either use these abilities or crumple beneath the invasion.
The Prime sat back, and his attendants seemed
concerned. They whispered among themselves. Bring order from the chaos, Navani thought. She gestured toward the bridgeman and lift. I understand your concern, but surely you have read our report of the oaths these radiants follow. Protection, remembering the fallen. Those oaths are proof that our cause is just, our radiance trustworthy. The powers are in safe hands, Your Majesty.
I think, ELA declared, we should stop dancing around and patting ourselves on the back.
Navani spun to face ELA. Don't sabotage this, she thought, meeting the woman's eyes. Don't you dare.
We are here, ELA continued, to focus our attention. We should be discussing where to invade to gain the best position for an extended war. Obviously, there is only one answer. Shinovar is a bounteous land. Their orchards grow without end. The land is so mild that even the grass has grown relaxed and fat. We should seize that land to supply our armies.
The others in the room nodded as if this were a perfectly acceptable line of conversation. With one targeted arrow, ELA Sadius proved what everyone whispered, that the Alethi were building a coalition to conquer the world, not just protect it.
The Shin Mountains present a historical problem, said the Tashiki ambassador. Attacking across or through them is basically impossible.
We have the Oath Gates now, Fenn said. Not to bring up that particular problem again, but has anyone investigated whether the Shin one can be opened? Having Shinovar as a redoubt, difficult to invade conventionally, would help secure our position.
Navani cursed ELA softly. This would only reinforce the Azish worry that the gates were dangerous. She tried to rein the discussion in, but it slipped away from her again.
We need to know what the Oath Gates do, Tashik was saying. Could the Alethi not share with us everything they've discovered regarding them? What about your people? Aladar shot back. They are the great traders in information. Could you share with us your secrets? All Tashiki information is freely available, at a huge price. We need... But Imul...
This whole thing is going to be a mess, Fenn said. I can see it already. We need to be able to trade freely, and Alethi greed could destroy this.
Alethi greed? ELA demanded. Are you trying to see how far you can push us? Because I assure you, Dalinar Kolin will not be intimidated by a bunch of merchants and bankers.
Please, Navani said into the growing uproar. Quiet. Nobody seemed to notice. Navani breathed out, then cleared her mind. Order from chaos. How could she bring order to this chaos? She stopped fretting and tried to listen to them. She studied the chairs they'd brought, the tone of their voices, their fears, hidden behind what they demanded or requested. The shape of it started to make sense to her. Right now, this room was full of building materials, pieces of Ephabriel. Each monarch, each kingdom was one piece. Dalinar had gathered them, but he hadn't formed them. Navani stepped up to the Azish Prime. People quieted as, shockingly, she bowed to him.
Your Excellency, she said upon rising. What would you say is the Azish people's greatest strength?
He glanced at his advisers as her words were translated, but they gave him no answer. Rather, they seemed curious to know what he'd say. Our laws, he finally replied.
Your famed bureaucracy, Navani said.
Your clerks and scribes, and by extension the great information centers of Tashik, the timekeepers and storm wardens of Yazir, the Azish legions. You are the greatest organizers on Roshar. I've long envied your orderly approach to the world.
Perhaps this is why your essay was so well received, Brightness Kolin, the Emperor said, sounding completely sincere.
In light of your skill, I wonder,
Would anyone in this room complain if a specific task were assigned to your scribes? We need procedures. A code of how our kingdoms are to interact, and how we're to share resources. Would you of Aesir be willing to create this? The viziers looked shocked, then immediately began talking to one another in hushed, excited tones. The looks of delight on their faces were enough proof that, yes, indeed, they'd be willing.
No, wait, Fen interjected. Are you talking of laws that we all have to follow?
Aunak nodded eagerly in agreement. More and less than laws, Navani said. We need codes to guide our interactions, as proven by today. We must have procedures on how we hold meetings, how to give each person a turn, how we share information.
I don't know if Thalina can agree to even that.
Well, surely you'd want to see what the codes contained first, Queen Fen, Navani said, strolling toward her. After all, we are going to need to administrate trade through the Oath Gates. I wonder, who has excellent expertise in shipping, caravans, and trade in general?
You'd give that to us? Fen asked, completely taken aback.
It seems logical. Sabariel choked softly on the snacks he'd been eating, and Pallona pounded him on the back. He'd wanted that job. That will teach you to show up late to my meeting and make only wisecracks, Navani noted. She glanced at Dalinar, who seemed worried. Well, he always seemed worried lately.
I'm not giving you the Oath Gates, Navani said to Fen. But someone has to oversee trade and supplies.
It would be a natural match for the Thalen merchants, so long as a fair agreement can be reached.
Huh, Fen said, settling back.
She glanced at her consort, who shrugged.
And the Alethi? The petite Yezir princess asked. What of you?
Well, we do excel at one thing, Navani said. She looked to Emul. Would you accept help from our generals and armies to help you secure what is left of your kingdom?
By every Kata-6 that has ever been holy, Emul said. Yes, of course. Please. I have several scribes who are experts in fortification,
Aladar suggested from his seat behind Dalinar and Yasna.
They could survey your remaining territory and give you advice on securing it. And recovering what we've lost?
Emul asked. Iele opened her mouth to speak, perhaps to extol the virtues of Alethi warmongering again. Yasna cut her off, speaking decisively.
I propose we entrench ourselves first. Tukar, Eri, Shinovar. Each of these looks tempting to attack, but what good will that do if we stretch ourselves too far? We should focus on securing our lands as they now stand.
Yes, Dalinar said. We shouldn't be asking ourselves where should we strike, but instead, where will our enemies strike next? They've secured 3 positions, High Prince Aladar said. Eri, Marat, and Alethkar.
But you sent an expedition, Fen said. To reclaim Alethkar.
Navani caught her breath, glancing at Dalinar. He nodded slowly.
Alethkar has fallen, Navani said. The expedition failed. Our homeland is overrun.
Navani had expected this to prompt another burst of conversation, but instead it was greeted only by stunned silence. Yasna continued for her. The last of our armies have retreated into Herdaz or Yakaved, harried and confused by enemies who can fly, or by the sudden attacks of shock troops of Parshmen. Our only holdouts are on the southern border, by the sea. Kolinar has fallen completely. The Oath Gate is lost to us. We've locked it on our side so that it cannot be used to reach Yirithiru.
I'm sorry,
Fenn said. My daughter is correct, Navani said, trying to project strength, while admitting that they had become a nation of refugees. We should apply our efforts first toward making sure no more nations fall.
My homeland, the Prime of Imul began. No, Nura said in thickly accented Alethi. I'm sorry, but no. If the Voidbringers had wanted your last nibble of land, Vexel, they'd have taken it. The Alethi can help you secure what you have, and it seems generous of them to do so. The enemy brushed past you to gather in Marat, conquering only what was necessary on the way. Their eyes are turned elsewhere.
Oh, my, Taravangian said. Could they be coming for me?
It does seem a reasonable assumption, Aunak said. The Vaden civil war left the country in ruin, and the border between Alethkar and Yakavet is porous.
Maybe, Dalinar said. I fought on that border. It's not as easy a battlefield as it would seem.
We must defend Yakavet, Taravangian said. When the king gave me the throne, I promised I'd care for his people. If the Voidbringers attack us...
The worry in his voice gave Navani an opportunity. She stepped back into the center of the room.
We won't allow that to happen, will we?
I will send troops to your aid, Taravangian, Dalinar said. But one army can be construed as an invading force, and I am not intending to invade my allies, even in appearance. Can we not mortar this alliance with a show of solidarity? Will anyone else help?
The Azish Prime regarded Dalinar. Behind him, the viziers and scions conducted a private conversation by writing on pads of paper. When they finished, Vizier Nura leaned forward and whispered to the Emperor, who nodded.
We will send 5 battalions to Yakavet, he said. This will prove an important test of mobility through the Oath Gates. King Taravangian, you will have the support of Azir.
Navani released a long breath in relief. She gave leave for the meeting to take a pause, so that people could enjoy refreshment, though most would probably spend it strategizing or relaying events to their various allies. The High Princes became a flurry of motion, breaking into individual houses to converse. Navani settled down in her seat beside Dalinar.
You've promised away a great deal, he noted. Giving Fenn control of trade and supply?
Administration is different from control, Navani said. But either way, did you think you were going to make this coalition work without giving something up?
No. Of course not.
He stared outward. That haunted expression made her shiver.
What did you remember, Dalinar? And what did the Night Watcher do to you? They needed the Blackthorn. She needed the Blackthorn. His strength to quiet the sick worry inside of her. His will to forge this coalition.
She took his hand in hers, but he stiffened, then stood up. He did that whenever he felt he was growing too relaxed. It was as if he was looking for danger to face. She stood up beside him.
We need to get you out of the tower, she decided. To get a new perspective, visit someplace new.
That, Dalinar said, voice hoarse, would be good.
Taravangian was speaking of having you tour Vaidenar personally. If we're going to send Kolin troops into the kingdom, it would make sense for you to get a feel for the situation there.
Very well.
The Azish called for her, asking for clarification on what direction she wanted them to take with their coalition bylaws. She left Dalinar, but couldn't leave off worrying about him. She'd have to burn a glyph word today, 12 of them, for Elokar and the others. Except, part of the problem was that Dalinar claimed nobody was watching the prayers as they burned, sending twisting smoke to the Tranquiline halls. Did she believe that? Truly? Today she'd taken a huge step toward unifying Roshar. Yet she felt more powerless than ever.
97. Ryaino. Of the unmade, Ja'anat was most feared by the Radiance. They spoke extensively of her ability to corrupt Spren, though only lesser Spren, whatever that means. From Hesse's Mythica, page 89. Kaladin remembered holding a dying woman's hand. It had been during his days as a slave. He remembered crouching in the darkness, thick forest underbrush scratching his skin, the night around him too quiet. The animals had fled. They knew something was wrong. The other slaves didn't whisper, shift, or cough in their hiding places. He'd taught them well. We have to go. Have to move. He tugged on Nalma's hand. He'd promised to help the older woman find her husband, who had been sold to another household. That wasn't supposed to be legal, but you could get away with doing all kinds of things to slaves with the right brands, especially if they were foreign. She resisted his tug, and he could understand her hesitance. The underbrush was safe, for the moment. It was also too obvious. The Bright Lords had chased them in circles for days, getting closer and closer. Stay here, and the slaves would be captured. He tugged again, and she passed the signal to the next slave all the way down the line. Then she clung to his hand as he led them, as quietly as he could, toward where he remembered a game trail. Getaway. Find freedom. Find honor again. It had to be out there somewhere. The snapping sound of the trap closing sent a jolt through Kaladin. A year later, he still wondered how he missed stepping in it himself. It got Nalma instead. She yanked her hand from his as she screamed. Hunter's horns moaned in the night. Light burst from newly unshielded lanterns, showing men in uniforms among the trees. The other slaves broke, bursting out of the underbrush like game for sport. Next to Kaladin, Nalma's leg was caught in a fierce steel trap, a thing of springs and jaws that they wouldn't even use on a beast for fear of ruining the sport. Her tibia jutted through her skin.
"Oh, Stormfather,"
Kaladin whispered as Painspren writhed around them.
"Stormfather!"
He tried to staunch the blood, but it spurted between his fingers.
"Stormfather, no! Stormfather!"
"Kaladin!"
she said through clenched teeth.
"Kaladin, run!"
Arrows cut down several of the fleeing slaves. Traps caught two others. In the distance, a voice called,
"Wait! That's my property you're cutting down!"
"A necessity, Bright Lord,"
a stronger voice said, the local High Lord.
"Unless you want to encourage more of this behavior."
So much blood. Kaladin uselessly made a bandage as Nalma tried to push him away to make him run. He took her hand and held it instead, weeping as she died. After killing the others, the Bright Lords found him still kneeling there. Against reason, they spared him. They said it was because he hadn't run with the others, but in truth, they'd needed someone to bear warning to the other slaves. Regardless of the reason, Kaladin had lived. He always did. There was no underbrush here in Shadesmar, but those old instincts served Kaladin well as he crept toward the lighthouse. He'd suggested that he scout ahead, as he didn't trust this dark land. The others had agreed. With lashings, he could get away most easily in an emergency, and neither Adolin nor Azure had experience scouting. Kaladin didn't mention that most of his practice sneaking had come as a runaway slave. He focused on staying low to the ground, trying to use rifts in the black stone to hide his approach. Fortunately, stepping silently wasn't difficult on this glassy ground. The lighthouse was a large stone tower topped by an enormous bonfire. It threw a flagrant orange glow over the point of the peninsula. Where did they get the fuel for that thing? He drew closer, accidentally startling a burst of life spren which shot up from some crystalline plants, then floated back down. He froze, but heard no sounds from the lighthouse. Once he got a little closer, he settled down to watch for a while to see if he could spot anything suspicious.
He sorely missed the diaphanous form Syl had in the physical realm. She could have reported back to the others what he'd seen, or even scouted into the building herself, invisible to all but the right eyes. After a short time, something crawled out of the beads of the ocean near him. A round, lurg-like creature with a fat, bulbous body and squat legs. About the size of a toddler, it hopped close to him, then tipped the entire top half of its head backward. A long tongue shot up in the air from the gaping mouth. It began to flap and wave. Storms. An anticipation spren? They looked like streamers on his side. But those were waving tongues? What other simple, stable parts of his life were complete lies? Two more anticipation spren joined the first, clustering near him and deploying their long, wagging tongues. He kicked at them. Shoo! Deceptively solid, they refused to budge. So he tried calming himself, hoping it would banish them. Finally, he just continued forward, his three bothersome attendants hopping behind. That sorely undermined the stealth of his approach, making him more nervous, which in turn made the anticipation spren even more eager to stick with him. He managed to reach the wall of the tower, where he might have expected the heat of the enormous fire to be oppressive. Instead, he could barely feel it. Notably, the flames caused his shadow to behave normally, extending behind him instead of pointing toward the sun. He took a breath, then glanced up through the open shuttered window into the ground floor of the lighthouse. Inside, he saw an old shin man with furrowed, wrinkled skin and a completely bald head, sitting in a chair reading by sphere light. A human? Kaladin couldn't decide if that was a good sign or not. The old man began to turn a page in his book, then froze, looking up. Kaladin ducked down, heart thumping. Those stupid anticipation spren continued to crowd nearby, but their tongues shouldn't be visible through the window.
"Hello?"
an accented voice called from inside the lighthouse.
"Who's out there? Show yourself!"
Kaladin sighed, then stood up. So much for his promise to do some stealthy reconnaissance.
Shallan waited with the others in the shadow of a strange rock growth. It looked something like a mushroom made from obsidian, the height of a tree. She thought she'd seen its like before, during one of her glimpses into Shadesmar. Pattern said it was alive, but very, very slow. The group waited, pensive, as Kaladin scouted. She hated sending him alone, but Shallan knew nothing about that sort of work. Vale did, but Vale still felt broken from what had happened in Kolinar. That was dangerous. Where would Shallan hide now? As Radiant? Find the balance, Wit had said. Accept the pain, but don't accept that you deserved it. She sighed, then got out her sketchbook and started drawing some of the spren they'd seen.
So, Syl said, sitting on a rock nearby and swinging her legs. I've always wondered, does the world look weird to you? Or normal?
Weird, Pattern said. Same as for everyone.
I guess neither of us technically have eyes, Syl said, leaning back and looking up at the glassy canopy of their tree mushroom shelter. We're each a bit of power made manifest. We honor spren mimic honor himself. You cryptics mimic weird stuff?
The fundamental underlying mathematics by which natural phenomena occur. Truths that explain the fabric of existence.
Yeah, weird stuff.
Shallan lowered her pencil, looking with dissatisfaction at the attempt she'd made at drawing a fear spren. It looked like a child's scribble. Vale was seeping out. That has always been you, Shallan. You just have to admit it. Allow it.
I'm trying, Wit, she whispered.
You all right? Adolin asked, kneeling beside her, putting his hand on her back, then rubbing her shoulders. Storms that felt good. They'd walked entirely too far these last few days. He glanced at her sketchpad. More, what did you call it? Abstractionalism? She snapped the sketchpad closed. What is taking that bridge man so long? She glanced over her shoulder, which interrupted Adolin. Don't stop, she added, or I will murder you. He chuckled and continued working at her shoulders. He'll be fine. You were worried about him yesterday. He's got battle fatigue, but an objective will help with that. We have to watch him when he's sitting around doing nothing, not when he's got a specific mission.
If you say so.
She nodded toward Azure, who stood by the coast, staring across the ocean of beads.
What do you make of her?
That uniform is well tailored, Adolin said, but the blue doesn't work with her skin. She needs a lighter shade. The breastplate is overly much, like she's trying to prove something. I do like the cape, though. I've always wanted to justify wearing one. Father gets away with it, but I never could.
I wasn't asking for a wardrobe assessment, Adolin.
Clothing says a lot about people.
Yeah? What happened to the fancy suit you got in Kolinar?
He looked down, which stopped the massaging of shoulders for an unacceptable count of three, so she growled at him. It didn't fit me anymore, he said, resuming the massage. But you do raise an important problem. Yes, we need to find food and drink. But if I have to wear the same uniform this entire trip, you won't have to murder me. I'll commit suicide.
Shallan had almost forgotten that she was hungry. How odd.
She sighed, closing her eyes and trying not to melt too much into the feeling of his touch. Huh, Adolin said a short time later. Shallan, what do you suppose that is? She followed his nod and spotted an odd little spren floating through the air. Bone white and brown, it had wings extending to the sides and long tresses for a tail. In front of its body hovered a cube.
Looks like those glory spren we saw earlier, she noted. Only the wrong color, and the shape of the head is...
Corrupted, Syl said. That's one of Odium's.
As he stepped inside the lighthouse, Kaladin's instincts drove him to check to either side of the doorway for anyone waiting in ambush. The room seemed empty, save for furniture, the Shin Man, and some strange pictures on the walls. The place smelled of incense and spices. The Shin Man snapped his book closed.
Cutting it close, aren't you? Well, let us begin. We haven't much time.
He stood up, proving himself to be rather short. His odd clothing had puffed out portions on the arms, the trousers very tight. He walked to a door at the side of the chamber. I should fetch my companions, Kaladin said.
Ah, but the very best readings happen at the beginning of the high storm.
The man checked a small device that he took from his pocket.
Only 2 minutes off.
A high storm? Azure had said they didn't need to worry about those in Shadesmar. Wait, Kaladin said, stepping after the little man, who had entered a room built up against the base of the lighthouse. It had large windows, but its main feature was a small table at the center that held something lumpish covered by a black cloth. Kaladin found himself curious. That was good, after the darkness of the last few days. He stepped in, glancing to the sides again. One wall contained a picture of people kneeling before a bright white mirror. Another was a cityscape at dusk, with a group of low houses clustered before an enormous wall that had light glowing beyond it.
Well, let's begin,
the man said.
You have come to witness the extraordinary, and I shall provide it. The price is a mere 2 marks of stormlight. You shall be greatly rewarded in kind, both in dreams and luster.
I should really get my friends, Kaladin said. The man whipped the cloth off the table, revealing a large crystalline globe. It glowed with a powerful light, bathing the room in luminescence. Kaladin blinked against it. Was that stormlight?
Are you balking at the price? The man said.
What is the money to you? Potential? If you never spend it, you gain nothing by having it, and the witness of what is to come will far recompense you for small means expended.
Kaladin said, raising his hand against the light.
Storms, man. I have no idea what you're talking about.
The Shin Man frowned, face lit from below like the globe.
You came here for a fortune, didn't you? To the Rai-Ai Oracle? You wish me to see the unwalked paths during the high storm, when realms blend.
A fortune? You mean foretelling the future? Kaladin felt a bitter taste in his mouth.
The future is forbidden.
The old man cocked his head.
But isn't that why you came to see me?
Storms, no. I'm looking for passage. We heard that ships come by here.
The old man rubbed the bridge of his nose and sighed.
Passage? Why didn't you say so? And I was really enjoying the speech. Well, a ship? Let me check my calendars. I think supplies are coming soon.
He bustled past Kaladin, muttering to himself. Outside, the sky rippled with light. The clouds shimmered, gaining a strange ethereal luminescence. Kaladin gaped, then glanced back at the little man, who had fetched a ledger from a side table.
That, Kaladin said. Is that what a high storm looks like on this side?
Hmm? Oh, new, are you? Have you gotten into Shadesmar but not seen a storm pass? Did you come directly from the Perpendicularity?
The old man frowned.
Not a lot of people coming through there anymore.
That light. The bright sphere on the table, as large as a man's head and glowing with a milky light, shifted colors, matching the pearlescent ripples above. There was no gemstone inside that globe, and the light seemed different. Transfixing.
Here now,
the man said as Kaladin stepped forward.
Don't touch that. It's only for properly trained fo-
Kaladin rested his hand on the sphere and felt himself get carried away by the storm.
Shallan and the others dodged for cover, but too slowly. The strange spren flitted right under their small canopy. Overhead, the clouds started to ripple with a vibrant set of colors. The corrupted glory spren landed on Shallan's arm.
Odium suspects that you survived, a voice said in her mind.
That was the voice of the unmade from the mirror, Ja'anat.
He thinks something strange happened to the Oathgate because of our influence. We've never managed to enlighten such powerful spren before. It's believable that something odd might happen. I lied and said I think you were sent far, far from the point of transfer. He has minions in this realm, and they will be told to hunt you, so take care. Fortunately, he doesn't know that you're a light weaver. He thinks you are an else caller for some reason. I will do what I can, but I'm not sure he trusts me any longer. The spren fluttered away.
Wait, Shallan said. Wait! I have questions! Syl tried to snatch it, but it dodged and was soon out over the ocean.
Kaladin rode the storm. He'd done this before, in dreams. He'd even spoken to the Stormfather. This felt different. He rode in a shimmering, rippling surge of colors. Around him, the clouds streamed past at incredible speed, coming alike with those colors, pulsing with them, as if to a beat. He couldn't feel the Stormfather. He couldn't see a landscape beneath him, just shimmering colors and clouds that faded into light. Then a figure. Dalinar Kholin, kneeling someplace dark, surrounded by 9 shadows, a flash of glowing red eyes. The enemy's champion was coming. Kaladin knew in that moment, an overpowering sensation thrumming through him, that Dalinar was in terrible, terrible danger. Without help, the Blackthorn was doomed.
Where?
Kaladin screamed to the light as it began to fade.
When? How do I reach him?
The colors diminished.
Please!
He saw a flash of a vaguely familiar city, Tall, built along the stones, it had a distinctive pattern of buildings at the center, a wall, and an ocean beyond. Kaladin dropped to his knees in the fortune-teller's room. The little shin man batted Kaladin's hand from the glowing sphere.
Fortune seers like myself. You'll ruin it, or...
He trailed off, then took Kaladin's head, turning it toward him.
You saw something.
Kaladin nodded weakly.
How? Impossible. Unless... You're invested. What heightening are you?
He squinted at Kaladin.
No. Something else. Merciful Doma. A surge binder. It has begun again?
Kaladin stumbled to his feet. He glanced at the large globe of light, which the lighthouse keeper covered up again with the black cloth, then put his hand to his forehead, which had begun thumping with pain. What had that been? His heart still raced with anxiety.
I need to go get my friends, he said.
Kaladin sat in the main room of the lighthouse, in the chair Iaino, the Shin lighthouse keeper, had occupied earlier.